The following podcast of the STR radio program is made possible through the generous support of our listeners. You can support this podcast by going to str.org and making a donation today.
Tricky time coming up. Hello, folks. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. And it doesn't matter how many times I've heard those little clips things at the beginning. I always chuckle at them. Glad you've joined me today. And I'm looking forward to talking to you here if you'd like to give me a call. Lines are, well, got filled up pretty quickly. Number's 1-800-227-5278. Of course, this is the place, Stand to Reason, where I stand to reason for classical Christianity, classical Christian values, trying to make the case that Christianity is worth thinking about. Of course, you can call in on anything in the area of ethics, values, and religion, and I'll try to give you a piece of my mind, which is what I expect from you as well. So, just got back last evening, pulled into my driveway at about 9:30 at night. Both my girls ran out the front door in the dark and ran up to Papa to give him a big hug. I've been gone for 5 days. By the way, that alone, for those of you who are parents, you know what I'm talking about here. But, you know, they say that being a parent is the hardest job you'll ever love, right? Well, that was one of those love moments. I mean, it just makes all the other challenge and difficulty and sacrifice worthwhile. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that that's satisfying, but that just kind of brings it to a head. And when you have moments like that, in any event, I was in Milwaukee for 5 days, and most of the time at the Hyatt there downtown, where the Evangelical Theological Society and Evangelical Philosophical Society, ETS and EPS, have their joint annual conference, and this is where all the smart guys kind of converge for 5 days, 3 or 4 days a year. We get there a little early to make sure we get the whole thing. I leave on Saturday, which is the day after the end of it, but that's partly because of my involvement with the EPS conference, which is a local church apologetics conference. Since all the guys are in town, the idea is let's get them into a local church and do an apologetics conference. That was William Lane Craig's brainchild, and it's been going now for, I think, 11 years. So I've participated in all every year but one around the country as this thing has moved. And I'm glad to be able to do that, but that's why I get back on Saturday, because I usually have either Friday night or a Saturday talk to give, and then I head back in time to make it to the show here on Sunday. But it is always a deeply satisfying thing for me to be among my colleagues who, you know, we spend the day working hard, thinking profound thoughts, and sharing them with each other. And then we relax in the evening over dinner and just continue to enjoy each other's company. And it is a time when I get to see friends that I haven't seen for maybe a year since the last event like this. It's a time where I get to spend more time with my what I call my young guns, Alan Schliemann and Brett Kunkel. And it's a time for meeting new people that are, in a sense, in the business, that are in apologetics or in philosophy or academics of different sorts, people whose books we've read, or maybe we've had them on the air here but never went face-to-face with them, and here we get to sit down and have a meal with them and get to know them better. All of this is wonderful. Plus, I spent a lot of time writing while I was there, and I will be talking about that second hour, because the issue is one of the hardest issues that I've ever had to deal with. In fact, it's the issue I least like having come up in conversation. I pray it won't come up. I cringe when it does. So I'll tell you about that in our second hour together. But the other reason that I like ETS so much, and the EPS Apologetics Conference that goes along with it at some local church in whatever town where the EPS-ETS conference is held. And by the way, next year it's going to be in Maryland. I think that would be Baltimore, my suspicions. It's always the week before Thanksgiving, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. The conference for lay people is usually Thursday night, Friday night, and all day Saturday. And there's an unbelievable lineup. The opening talk was given by Lee Strobel on Tuesday, or rather Thursday last week, in this particular case. I don't know what the lineup is for next year. I hope I'm included. But, you know, I did a workshop this time, and I was competing with William Lane Craig and Frank Beckwith, among others, for a workshop. That's how good it is at a conference that is held along with the EPS conference. So that'll be in Baltimore. Mark your calendar if you like, coming up next year. But I'll tell you what, I was mentioning the other thing that I really like about these kinds of events, not just the professional side, but especially the church apologetics conferences. I have people coming up to me constantly, telling me that they enjoy the show, they enjoy Stand to Reason, they enjoy the website, they enjoy Tactics, they enjoy the Ambassador Guide to Islam and to Mormonism that the other guys have produced. They enjoy and have deeply benefited from what Stand to Reason does. Now, that's always an encouragement to me, because here I sit behind the microphone, or I go out and give talks and we write things, and this is true with the other guys as well. We really are penetrating much more than we're aware of, and in some ways, it's probably good for us, because it causes us not to think so much about ourselves and instead keep thinking about the work. But every once in a while, it's good to have people come up and say, by the way, you've made a big difference, and thank you. And at events like ETS EPS every year, there's lots of people on the professional side of the conference and also on the layman side. People will stop me and tell me that. So thank you for all of you who said hi for the first time face-to-face with me. And we got to shake hands, and I got to thank you for being listeners, users, and people who are paying it forward, as it were, and making a difference with the things that we have passed on to you. Because keep in mind, we stand on the shoulders of those that came before us. And now you, in a sense, stand on our shoulders. You're going to pass it forward to somebody who's going to stand on yours. And that's the way it works. You thank me, and I appreciate that, but the biggest thanks is paying it forward, which is what so many of you are doing, especially in what I call the third column, that massive group of people who are in the local church and local communities, face-to-face with the average Joe, taking the things that you've learned and putting them into play in a winsome and attractive way. So that's the other thing that makes things just great for me. I got to tell you, before we go to calls, though, I got to tell you about a conversation that I had the first night there. So I get in about 6:30 at night, hooked up with Frank Beckwith in Houston. He flew into Houston, I did, and since Frankie Beckwith, his wife, is my Stand to Reason's travel agent, she put Frank and I in the same seat on the same flight from Houston to Milwaukee, so we get to catch up a little bit. Anyway, I get in, we take a cab into town, and then I meet up with my guys. We go out to dinner, meeting with a whole bunch of people. So that first night, we're all excited, we're getting together, we're carrying on and talking, and the waiter comes up, and he's making small talk with us, too. And these are always opportunities that I like to at least look. These are occasions when I look for an opportunity to try to make it useful for the kingdom. And you know me. I'm going to ask some questions. I'm going to try to draw that person out. I'm going to see if this dog is going to hunt or not. And a lot of times it doesn't. It goes nowhere. But sometimes we get into a conversation. Now, I have to tell you that I was a little self-conscious, because I had Alan Schleiman there, and Brett Kunkel there, and Mary Jo Sharp there, and a whole bunch of other smart folk that are in the apologetics, and they're teachers and instructors. But I'm the guy who wrote the book on tactics, right? So I know if I open my mouth, everybody's going to stop talking and listen to see how the guy who wrote the book does it. So there's a lot of pressure on me. And I tried not to think about that. And I was also thinking with this waiter, who was quite talkative, and it was the kind of restaurant where it was really relaxed environment. We were actually kicking back for the evening, no pressure. We weren't going to leave for a while. And so there was this interactive environment. And so the waiter, whose name is Nick, was engaging us in all sorts of things. Now, it turns out that this particular restaurant in Milwaukee is in an old building. It's like a three-flat. You know, these are an old brick three-flat. It's a storefront on the bottom where the restaurant is, and then there's two stories above it. It's the kind of thing you see a lot in Midwestern cities. And there's no buildings around it. In fact, it's in a beat-up neighborhood. I don't even know how we found it, but we all got there, and we ended up going back three nights in a row because we enjoyed the atmosphere and the ability to have casual conversation till late into the night. But it turns out that this particular building is allegedly haunted. And there's, you know, they have ghost T-shirts that they sell there, and they told us a little bit about the history. And the waiter says that there's some people who will come in, and they'll rent out rooms above, and will spend the night and bring Ouija boards and try to conjure up ghosts. And some will even bring, like, electromagnetic devices. So here I see an opening. And my comment was, or my question was, why would anybody think that they could detect an immaterial presence with an electromagnetic device that's meant to measure something physical? So now I toss this out to him, and he picks up right away. He's following me, right? But he said, well, there are those ghosts can materialize. An example, and then he says something, and I can't remember exactly what he's referring to. I mean, I know what he's referring to, but I can't remember his exact words. But he says something like, you know, in that book, you know, that ancient or that old holy book or whatever, you know, the main guy in there had two ghosts appear to him. Now, he's talking about the Transfiguration. But he doesn't say the Bible, and he doesn't say Jesus. But I realize who he's talking about. And so I say, hey, you can say Jesus here. You're not going to bother any of us. This is what I said. That's fine with us. But he's still, you know, he's still being, what's the word? Odd, I guess, as he's talking about this, you know. And so I said, yeah, that's the Transfiguration. It was Moses and Elijah. Now, what I'm trying to do in commenting is I'm trying to encourage him, let him know that he's in, you know, he's among friends if he wants to talk about that kind of thing. But I'm also trying to cue him off that I know a little bit about this stuff. And then he says something like, well, you know, Jesus, you know, I think he uses Jesus' name by that point. And he said, Jesus is all about, loving the Father. I think that was and loving others. That was the main thing of his teaching. Now, whenever anybody says to me that XYZ is the main point of Jesus' life, and they never get it right, by the way, I always ask them a question. It's a simple question. It's a fair question. I asked it that night. I said, oh, are you a student of the life of Jesus? And Nick looked at me like there were lobsters coming out of my ears. It stopped him in his tracks, and he was a little bit incredulous, like, what does that have to do with anything that I've said? And he hemmed and hawed a little bit. And then head on off in another direction. And I said, well, I'm just trying to find out if you said you have an idea what Jesus' life is all about. He said, yeah, well, you know, he said that the Father, only the Father is good. Well, actually, someone said to him, good teacher. And he says, why do you call me good? Nobody's good but God. When I guess he meant the Father, I guess, but, you know, so I'm trying to, again, weigh in, let him know I know a little bit about this stuff, and but also to push back a little bit on the main purpose of Jesus' life. Because look at the main purpose of Jesus' life, getting that question right is the most important thing in life. Jesus asked his disciples, who do you say that I am? He asked them the most important question they could ever deal with. Now, when Peter, he first asked, who do men say? And they said, well, this, that, and the other, just kind of like Nick that night. well, we got all these ideas. What are you about you? Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Peter gets it right. And so this is why I'm pressing the issue a little bit. I want to get him thinking. I'm trying to put a stone in his shoe. And but I have to tell you that it is not going smoothly. Now, what I've told you so far sounds pretty straightforward, but that's a condensation of about a couple of minutes of conversation where he's firing out these scattered things that seem to have very little to do with what I'm saying, and he's still trying to be the smart guy who knows more about it than everybody else. And I'm not trying to pin him down. I'm not trying to make him feel bad. I'm not trying to stick him in a corner or trap him. In fact, I told him that. And I'm very mellow here. And indeed, I asked Alan Schliemann afterwards, just give me some feedback. How did I do? That is, was I coming on too strong or anything? He said, no, you gave him a lot of room to move. In fact, you even gave him a lot of chances to leave because he's a waiter. He had other people, presumably. And he would pause, look around at other tables and see if there's any problems. But then he jumped back in. So he wanted to stay and play here, but he wasn't speaking anything coherently. And after I'd asked the same question a couple different times and not gotten anything from him, I said, well, I figure maybe I'll ask something that will be more comfortable for him. We're wondering if you've ever seen anything supernatural. And we're talking about the ghosts around the restaurant. He said, well, everything's supernatural. I said, everything supernatural? He says, well, don't you think everything's supernatural? And I said, you want me to answer that question? Really? He says, well, you might consider it a rhetorical question. Well, if it's a rhetorical question, you don't want me to answer it, right? Well, you might think of it that way. Well, how do you think about it? It's your question. Tell me whether it's rhetorical or not. And so then he ambles off in some other direction. And I lift up the glass of water. I said, well, is this supernatural? And here's a glass. Is this water supernatural? And he says, Jesus walked on water. Now, you might be thinking, what does that have to do with anything of the question? And that's what I was thinking. But this is the way this conversation was going. And I said, well, Jesus walking on water is supernatural, but the water... The water isn't supernatural. And he said, 80% of your body is made up of water. Okay, now you're probably wondering, what's the connection of that statement to what just came before? That's the same thing I was wondering. But this is the way the conversation was going. And, of course, everybody at the table is dead quiet as they watch the master maneuver. And I'm getting nowhere. I mean, it's just an absolute mess. And finally, he just walked. I wish I could remember what he said, because he quoted some Bible verse, and I think he probably misquoted it a little bit, but he offered it with great flourish, and then he just walked away. And I'm looking around at the people at the table, and I'm wondering, what just happened? Now, let me tell you the reason that I'm telling you this, and then we'll go to break, and I'll get to your calls, because they're... A lot of you folks on the line, I'm looking forward to talking to you. The reason I'm telling you this is that when I write a book about tactics, or I give a talk on tactics, I can relay experiences that I've had using the techniques, which experiences demonstrate or illustrate something about the point that I'm talking about in the talk or in the book. And the false impression that you are liable to get is that it always goes really smoothly for the master. It's always clean. It's always tidy. It's always just so. I always get the last word and come out smelling like roses. It ain't that way, folks. I mean, I've got to take these incidents and condense them down in a coherent way to tell you what happened. And it has the effect of making it sound tidier than it might have been. And look, sometimes it is tidy, but it isn't always. And on Tuesday night last week, I had one of the most untidy conversations I have ever had using the tactical approach with all of my colleagues watching, which is all right. Because that's real life. It's not always tidy. Sometimes you move forward in a herky-jerky fashion. sometimes the dog doesn't hunt, and you're left just kind of holding the bag, and you don't know where to go, and you feel a little stupid. This is why I tell people, when it comes to the tactical approach, it comes to the Colombo game plan that I describe in the book Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions. You're not going to swing for the fences. You're not trying to hit home runs. As far as I'm concerned, you don't even need to get on base. You just need to get up to bat and then see what happens. And the things that are taught in that book and things I talk about here on the show are meant largely to get you up to bat. And then you never know what's going to happen, because sometimes you may fan real quickly and you're down for the count. I guess that was mixing my metaphors a little bit, but you get the point. And sometimes you connect, and sometimes you hit a little dribble into the infield and you make it to first base. Sometimes you hit a homer. But you're not in charge of that. Not that part. God's in charge of that part. What I want you to do is get up to base and then take what comes. Sometimes, though, what comes is not pretty, like last Tuesday night. Anyway, I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. We'll get to your calls after this.
In the United States, over 51 million abortions have been performed since it was legalized in 1973. That's one abortion every 26 seconds. If you have been wanting to be able to speak out effectively against abortion, or just be better prepared to discuss this often heated and always emotional topic, STR has a great resource to help equip you to do that. Stand to Reason Interactive, Making Abortion Unthinkable, prepares you for any pro-life encounter, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with the confidence that your case is solid, your knowledge deep, and your argument just. Created to be used as a personal study or in a small group setting in your church or home, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned, plug-and-play course provides the basic training for anyone to become proficient in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through video, workbooks, role-playing, and quizzes, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to restore meaning to the word abortion using compelling visual aids, simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, present scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric, clear the red herring objections, and stay on course, be respectful toward the person you're talking with. If you haven't yet taken a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at str.org.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. When we read the Gospels or one of Paul's letters, can we be confident that 2,000 years later we have what they originally wrote? The answer is a clear yes, and all we have to do is point to the facts. Find out what those facts are in my Bulletproof podcast this month. Look for Bulletproof on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Is God just a crutch? Was Jesus a fraud? Are science and faith antithetical? Christian apologist and philosopher Greg Kokel applies his trademark clear thinking to these and other vexing issues facing believers today in Faith Is Not Wishing, 13 Essays for Christian Ambassadors. Through this thoughtful approach, Greg demonstrates that Christian faith is not wishful thinking, but rather a sure conviction grounded in evidence. Visit Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org to get a copy of Faith Is Not Wishing, or call 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800-2-REASON.
Ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel, your host. I'm with you live every Sunday from 2 to 5. That means you can call if you're listening on the podcast on Sundays, 2 to 5 L.A. time, because I'm in L.A. I could say Seattle time, couldn't I? Or could I say some city in South America? Bolivia. Bolivia time. No, Bolivia probably, that's a big country, isn't it? Well, anyway, I don't want to confuse people. L.A. time's fine. Let's go to Green Bay, Wisconsin, and Jesse. And Jesse, did I meet you over the last couple of days while I was in Milwaukee?
No, I wish I could have been there. I was actually driving through Milwaukee on Friday night, but it just didn't work out for me to be there.
Oh, yeah. Well, because I did meet some people from Green Bay, and I remember telling them that you have some great smallmouth fishing just up the coast there, from Green Bay and Sturgeon Bay. They're very big smallmouth there in that part of Lake Michigan. Are you fishermen?
I'm not.
Oh,
no.
Okay. Well, well, that's all right, because we have more. We have bigger fish to fry right now, don't we?
I have good. I've heard good things about the fishing in Door County, though.
Yeah, and Door County is one of the prettiest places in the country I've ever been.
Yeah,
it's really nice. That would be, for people who don't know, that's kind of the finger that from Wisconsin. Oh, well, Melinda says the thumb. It depends how you're holding your hand, I guess. But in any event, it is the protuberance that goes out into Lake Michigan from your area of Wisconsin. That beautiful, it almost looks like New England, you know, when I go. And they got a lot of lighthouses around the coast and whatever. So you're in a nice part of the country there, Jesse. What's on your mind?
Great. My question is, I'm sure you've already seen the question, but question is loyalty biblical?
Mm-hmm.
And I realize, first off, that questioning whether or not loyalty is biblical is sort of like questioning whether smiling is good. Like, even if you happen to be right,
yeah, it, seems,
it doesn't sound good for you. But
yes, right, right. Well, when I saw, I have never been asked this question before, and I had to pause and think a little bit about that. Because the question is not whether loyalty is a virtue, but whether it's a virtue that is biblically supported. All right?
Right, right. And I want to give you a little bit of background of how I came to this question so you understand where I'm coming from. I teach your tactics curriculum. Well, I use the DVD curriculum in my Sunday school class, and we just got to the lesson on the suicide tactic. And it just happened that our pastor preached a sermon on loyalty that same week, and his main text had to do with Ruth and Naomi, and that was his main support for this idea of loyalty, was that Ruth was blessed because of her loyalty to Naomi, to Israel, to the God of Israel. And then another example he used is that the Civil War could have been avoided if Texans had been loyal to the Union. Now, Texas was independent at the time, but Sam Houston wanted to be loyal to the Union, join the Union, but the state of Texas ended up joining the Confederacy, and he said that if Texas had been loyal to the Union, then the Civil War would have been avoided because they just wouldn't have been strong enough.
That is very hard for me to believe, that particular point. But that is a point about history, and I've done quite a bit of study in the past on the Civil War. I've been focusing more on the Second World War of late. But that is hard to believe, because keep in mind that when Lincoln became president, he was elected in the fall, and when he was sworn in, half the country was gone. These states were falling like flies, dropping like flies, and they weren't taking Texas's counsel in it.
Okay.
And the war then was inevitable to get them back. I know the South fired the first shot, but they, but regardless of that, they still were going, they weren't going to come back without a fight, and they weren't, they were a very loose Confederacy because of the states' rights issue. You know, they were independent, sovereign nations. That's the way they saw themselves. And, in fact, Robert E. Lee was offered the command of the Union Army, and he said, though he was against slavery, he had to fight for his country, which was Virginia. So, you know, that particular point, as a historical thing, is hard for me to accept. However, excuse me, it, even so, he is talking there descriptively about loyalty, excuse me, if the Texans were loyal descriptively to this, to the Union, then on his view, the Civil War wouldn't have been fought. But that isn't to say, that isn't to make the case that loyalty itself is a virtue, because you could have, you could have, well, look at Robert E. Lee was being loyal to his country, Virginia. And that caused him to take the other side and arguably extend the Civil War through his masterful leadership. In fact, there was some question whether Union was going to win at all until midway, till Gettysburg, really. And that's halfway through the war. So there, that can be played both ways if you're using the issue of loyalty merely descriptively.
Okay. I think you're getting to where I'm heading here already.
Okay.
And the thing that I'm wondering is, I think I sort of smell a suicide here, in that specifically with the case of Ruth and Naomi, in order for Ruth to become loyal to Naomi and Israel and the God of Israel, didn't she have to abandon her loyalty to her country and her family and the gods that
That's
she
right.
worshipped
that
before
is
this?
That is a great observation. That passage. Now, I have a point of view about your question proper, but all we're talking about at this point is your pastor's proof texts. And I don't see that his statement about Texas was either, I don't see that it was, first of all, historically accurate, but it's maybe a matter of opinion there. But I, even if it were, it's just an example of lack of loyalty that might have led to a bad conclusion, but then you have similar examples of loyalty that could have led to a bad end too, like Robert E. Lee. So you're not going to get help from that, because you can find examples on both sides of the spectrum there. It doesn't answer the question of whether Texas ought to have been loyal to the Union for loyalty's sake, or whether.
Right.
Or whether Robert E. Lee should have been loyal to Virginia for loyalty's sake. It doesn't answer that question. So,
right, and I think that's my issue, is whether or not loyalty actually does anything, or if it's just sort of an attachment that you attach to, I've decided that this thing is true or that this thing is good, and now the feeling I have about this thing is that I'm going to continue to be loyal.
I actually think loyalty is a virtue, but like, and I'll tell you why in a minute, and I think biblically it can be demonstrated, but because I thought of two examples. The first one I thought of before we started talking, and the second one, which is even more effective, I thought of while we were talking. I mean, it's more decisive, I think. But I want to go back just for a moment to Ruth and Naomi.
Okay.
Certainly it was Ruth's faithfulness to Naomi that put her in a position to be on the right side with God's people. But it could also have been the case that Naomi was faithful to Ruth and she stayed there with the Midianites or Canaanites or whoever, I can't remember,
Moabites, I believe.
That's right.
Sure.
You're right. No, you're right. But she could have stayed with the Moabites, and then loyalty would have put her on the wrong side of the equation. So
right, and that's my concern.
Okay, I don't think the lesson that we get out of Ruth and Naomi is the lesson of the virtue of loyalty. I think the lesson we get from Ruth and Naomi is that you got to be with the right team. Okay. Now,
okay,
by the way, the Ruth Naomi thing is a beautiful picture of loyalty. There's no question. And there's that famous verse, my people shall be your people, or your people will be my people, et cetera, et cetera. And this is used in weddings, I think. And I don't think it's inappropriate if it's expressing the sentiments of the people in the wedding. So this is just fine. But it is not the loyalty per se that is the important thing in that case. It is that she chose the right side to be loyal to. That's what's critical with Ruth and Naomi. So I'm not going to stand behind your pastor's proof text. I think he would have been better to use some other text. And the first one that I thought about is the loyalty of the mighty men to David. Now, this also is descriptive. But it does seem there is a suggestion in the account that their loyalty was a good thing in itself. And notice how at one point, as an expression of their loyalty, David said he was thirsty, and the mighty men went behind the enemy line to get water for David. And David was so moved by that, and this is something our culture wouldn't understand, this gesture, but he took the water and he poured it out. He, almost like a drink offering, because he wasn't going to drink that which his men had risked their lives to get. And so that was an act of respecting, honoring their act of loyalty to him. I think that whole story gives a picture of loyalty, first of all, which Ruth and Naomi did as well. But I think it suggests that their loyalty was virtuous. Okay, so in itself, it wasn't just that it was David the good guy, but loyalty is a virtuous thing. Now, keep in mind that any virtue can be abused. And so this is like the golden mean. You know, courage can be, on its extreme, can be rashness. And you do stupid things under the thinking you're being courageous and you're not. So the same thing, you could be loyal too long to a bad thing, and then the loyalty turns out to be misplaced and it poisons the virtue. Okay,
but okay. Could I just push back on that just for a little bit here?
Yeah, I'm going to give you a verse in a moment you won't be able to push back on, but go ahead and tell me this. What do you have in mind here, Jesse? Because I'm working up to the grand finale. Go ahead.
All right. My thought here is, couldn't these mighty men, or wouldn't these mighty men still have done the same thing without ascribing loyalty as the motivating factor? Isn't it true that they were also doing their job, and they saw that the king was discouraged, and they thought, if we bring him this thing that he's longing for, he'll be encouraged, and that will drive success in this battle that we're fighting.
Well, I guess you could characterize it that way, but when I read the text, that's not the sense I get. These men were deeply devoted to David. We will follow you anywhere. We will do anything for you. We'll even risk our lives to get a drink of water for you. And by the way, in terms of the discouragement and the thirst and all that, if a person's just doing their job, that is way above and beyond the call of duty if you're just thinking about your job description. So I think
If loyalty is going to actually perform some function and be useful in the conversation, don't we have to have some sort of example of, this is a situation where I know this thing on the left is the right thing to do, and this thing on the right is the wrong thing to do, but because of my loyalty, I'm willing to choose the thing that intellectually I know is not the right choice, and that I wouldn't have made this choice if it weren't for my loyalty.
Well, that would, if you had an example like that, that certainly would be an example of loyalty, though I would argue misplaced. Then the loyalty would be corrupted. But I don't know why we have to have a negative example. I don't know.
I'm just wondering what loyalty is doing if we already could have had these people making the same decision without loyalty. If they intellectually could have made the decision that this is the right thing to do, what role does loyalty play?
Well, but the thing is that it was the right thing to do simply in virtue of loyalty. It wasn't some other moral good that they were acting out. These men had no moral obligation to get this water for David. This was an act of extreme loyalty of them towards their leader, who they loved. So it seems to me that this is simply an example simply of the virtue of loyalty in action. But I'm going to give you the final what came to mind when we started talking about this.
Okay.
It strikes me as an open and shut case. And this comes from the mouth of Jesus. You'll recognize it immediately. Greater love has no man than that he lay down his life for his friend. Now, I can't think of a better description of loyalty than that. And it comes from the mouth of Jesus, clearly describing it as a virtue. It would have been better, I think, if your pastor had used that as a proof text and then used possibly the relationship of the mighty men with David as an example of loyalty. But both of them, I think, and certainly this statement from Jesus, I think, speak clearly of loyalty as a virtue from the text, which answers your question.
Okay, maybe I missed the loyalty there. It sounds like that's a description of something that a person would do for love.
Yes.
Are you using those as synonyms?
Well, if I were to ask you what loyalty was, if I ask you to give me a definition, and which we don't have time to do now, and we might have done at the beginning, but sometimes these things are better described than they are defined. And it strikes me that though other things may be entailed, certainly love, greater love is no man than this, I would say that if I laid down my life for a stranger, it would be an example of love also. If I lay down my life for a friend, it is a loving example of loyalty, or it's a loyal example of love, whatever, however you want to put it. But that adds the additional dimension of loyalty, because it strikes me that that's at the heart of what loyalty entails. It may not satisfy at this point, is something you can think about. It was a very good question, though, Jesse. All righty?
All right, thank you.
Got to run. Yep, I appreciate it. And always fun to struggle with something new. Time for a break, and then more of your calls and questions right here on Stand to Reason.
Call today to request the latest issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you represent your faith, even when discussing the most timely and heated subjects like evolution, cloning, stem cell research, and doctor-assisted suicide. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will teach you how to represent your faith as an ambassador for Christ in a concise and attractive manner. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org to request our newsletter, Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free when you call 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org.
Is science the only way we can discover knowledge? It turns out that not only are there other ways, some are more immediate and accurate than science. Find out what they are in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Find it on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Did God really say? It's the oldest temptation in human history, one that targets the authority of God's Word at its very foundation. Its modern rephrasing takes many forms, both in academia and in popular culture. Are the New Testament documents reliable? Have ancient biblical books been lost or suppressed by the early church? Are the words of the Bible just flawed human inventions? These questions introduce doubt at the point of contact between God and man, undermining the Christian's confidence in the words of Scripture. Even those secure in their affirmation of divine authorship must wrestle with similar questions. Did God really say to me? In other words, do the promises of Scripture apply to the individual Christian's life today or only to those originally addressed? How is one to understand and apply these biblical assurances? In this timely collection of essays called Ancient Words, Reflections on the Reliability and Proper Use of Scripture, Greg carefully addresses each of these issues, providing both solid evidence for the reliability of Scripture and a clear roadmap for how it should be read and applied. Greg's responses to these popular challenges to biblical authority will help reinforce your confidence in this trustworthy book. Go to Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org and get a copy of Ancient Words, or call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason.
I can only imagine what it will be like when I walk by your side. I can only imagine what my eyes will see.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. And just got the news that the Bible Fast Forward, which many of you have been listening to on CD for over a year, is we've got a target date for shipping, which is the week of December 6th. So that means we're ready to take pre-orders. If you want to call Stand to Reason at 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website at str.org. Is there a feature on our website, as far as you know, or will there be? Not yet. But you can well, then how would they go about? Well, I'll get more information to you about how you can order that. But just let you know that it's we're getting in the queue for that. And go to our store and pre-order at the Stand to Reason store. So there's not a feature right there on our web. There's not a feature on our homepage, is what I'm trying to say. Melinda's going to tweet the URL just in a few moments. So if you're following on Twitter, you'll be able to see that. So talk to a lot of people, amazingly, in the last few weeks that have told me we've been going through the Bible Fast Forward. It's been fantastic for us, and it's really opened our eyes. Now, keep in mind, Bible Fast Forward is 8 one-hour sessions, or 50-minute sessions, I guess, of fairly dense theology tracking the history of salvation from Abraham, where the rescue plan starts, Genesis chapter 12 right through its fulfillment in the person of Jesus in the New Testament. So it's not your like, you know, one-week Bible study. There's a workbook that's nearly 150 pages long. It's a PDF file. You copy it. You print it out. You copy it for whoever's in your group. And you are going to really love this class. So it'll be a great Christmas gift. And since I go through hand motions to help us remember the 10 major historical events of the nation of Israel, or make that the 12 major historical events, starting with the birth of Abraham. Those of you listening on the CD don't know what the hand motions are. Well, you'll see this now in the DVD, and we do it at the beginning of every session so people can get the big picture before we go into the minutia. I understand that there's also a YouTube thing with the hand motions available, too. So those of you who haven't seen them, you can conjure that up in YouTube. Let's go back to the calls now. And in Chicago, Courtney, welcome to the show, Courtney.
Hi, how are you, Greg?
I'm doing good. Good to hear from you.
That's great. First and foremost, I would like to give a shout-out to the enforcer, because I normally have to listen over the podcast, and over the past couple of podcasts I've heard, you know, there hasn't been many people shouting her out.
Okay. Well, good. I see the word Simon Greenleaf under here. Are you a former Simon Greenleaf student?
Oh, no, sir.
Okay, sorry. Then that was just a mistake.
I was just going to ask if you were, because in my personal study, before I get to my question.
Sure.
Because I looked up on Wikipedia, and the enforcer told me that basically your Wikipedia information was correct. And it just shocked me because I was like, oh, so that's why his tactics are so much different from everybody else's.
Oh, because of Simon Greenleaf. The tactics I didn't learn from anybody else, although certain aspects of the tactical approach are not particularly new, asking questions or identifying a self-refuting statement. That would be the suicide tactic or stuff. But when I was a Simon Greenleaf, I began developing them, and I think the very first time I ever taught tactics as a you know, thinking of putting these ideas together into a coherent form, I think I taught it for Craig Hazen when he was directing the program at Simon Greenleaf, which I was graduating from right around that time before I went on to the MA Phil program at Talbot. So that's probably the association you're thinking of.
Oh, no, actually, it just shocked me because in my personal time, I've been downloading books online and whatnot, and one of the books I recently downloaded was An Examination of the Testimony of Four Evangelicals.
That's
evidence.
That's Greenleaf. That's Simon Greenleaf. Oh, that's what.
Yes,
yes, sir. He was the author of that, and he was the person who the school was named after. Yeah, okay, great.
Right.
So, Courtney, what's on your mind today?
Oh, yes. Well, I saw your debate with the guy with the white hair about morals and how can you find objective, true morals.
Yeah, I think I've debated more than one guy with white hair, but you might be looking, is this the one in Calgary, Canada with John Baker, University of Calgary?
John Baker. Right, because you really couldn't hear him, but luckily everything he was going to say was posted right up on the screen.
Oh, yeah, but that was John Baker, and it was, I thought his presentation was quite confusing. Unfortunately for his people, because they were dissatisfied with the presentation, they thought he didn't do well, and of course their complaint was we should have got somebody better, but I don't think anybody's going to do any better trying to advance the idea of relativism or relative morality. Not that I'm that clever. I just think that that point of view is very difficult to defend. So anyway, so that I know the debate you're talking about.
Yeah, and right after that, because I saw it on YouTube, and that was like the only debate I could find of you on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
But after I saw that, one of my friends sent me a video that basically asked one question, and that was, what are these objective, true moral truths?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after I saw your video, I basically used some of your expressions, but expressed them my way, paraphrased them, you know, and I explained to him how you can find them. But, you know, he basically just kept going back to every other culture, you know, basically relativistic thinking.
Well, okay, let me respond to that quickly. It is not the case, it is a common misunderstanding that every culture has different values than other cultures. This simply is not true. There are variations, and Frank Beckwith and I talk about this in our book on relativism, but the variations oftentimes are variation not in values but in facts. So, for example, cultures characteristically have as a value respect for elders, but how one expresses respect for elders is factually different in different cultures. So in some cases, you bow down to your elders, and that's the way you show respect to them. And in some cultures, you kill them. That is, in certain cultures, when people get really old, you have a ceremonial execution. I mean, this doesn't happen very often, but it does happen in the ancient, I'm thinking up in Canada and some of those areas, you know, long time ago. The idea was that as an act of respect to the parents, instead of allowing the parents to get old and feeble and et cetera and a burden on other people, there is a respectful execution, strangulation, and they bury them. Now, this sounds bizarre to us, but I just want to – all I'm doing is pointing out that the value is the same in both cultures, though different cultures have ways of expressing that value. I picked one of the more extreme ones, but even within our culture, you have different ways of demonstrating respect to other people, you know, and manners at the table. In Thailand, you don't ask – in our country, you ask somebody to pass. You don't reach across their plate because that's disrespectful to them, all right? But in Thailand, if you ask somebody to pass something, they take it as you interrupting that person's meal, which is disrespectful to them. So you have the same value in play, that is, we ought to respect the people around us, but you have different ways that the value can be expressed. And that accounts for a massive number of the alleged differences in values. It's a distinction in facts, that is, how you express the value, than the underlying value itself. C.S. Lewis talks about this in Mere Christianity, that there seems to be a foundational set of values in everybody's culture. And he has a book, and I'm trying to remember the name of it, where he lists the common values of all cultures. It's in an appendix in one of his books, but in any event, he points out, like, in no culture do people think that cowardice is a virtue. It's always a vice. You might have people that are willing to be cowards and don't take it seriously, but cowardice itself is not. In every culture, taking human life has to have justification. Now, there are different understandings of what justification is. Like, it may be justified to take a member a life from another tribe if you want, but not of your own. But there is something special about human life. And on you go. So there is a factor just simply of reflection based on one's moral common sense that helps us to inform what is morally right and wrong. And when people have ethical discussions, this is what goes on. You're tossing around ideas and reflecting on them to see if they just seem right. Now, when I say they seem right, I don't mean that they're just inventing it. That, well, whatever turns me on kind of thing. No, the goal is to try to figure out what the right thing to do is, even if one's desire is to do the opposite. It might be my desire to run from responsibility, to shirk my responsibility. That satisfies as a Christian, I call it a fleshly desire, but, you know, it just satisfies more of a base hunger or desire. But most people, in reflecting on that, would say, you know what, though I may want to shirk my responsibility, it's not the right thing to do. though I may give in to that, I still have responsibilities towards other people, my family members, etc., that I ought to honor. And then they bring in the moral language. So one way of knowing what the objective morality is reflecting on humanity and how the wisdom of the ages and how they've over time kind of worked these things out and taking stock of one's own moral common sense. Another way is if God, who I think is necessary to ground morality ultimately, if God tells us. And so you can have a divine command approach to understanding morality. Ultimately, I think that's a sound way of looking at it with qualification. But there are some things that are right or wrong that may not occur to us right away, that if God simply tells us this is what he wants, then now we've got a crystal clear picture. Now, I'm speaking theoretically at this point, that if there is a God who grounds morality and he tells us what it is, that certainly is a way that we can know what morality amounts to. Now, finding out, well, what is that revelation, and where has God spoken about these things, and how do we know about trusting that revelation? That's a different question, but at least here we've addressed this, at least in principle. All right, there's our music. That's the end of our first hour. Hour number two just ahead, and I'll talk about the most difficult and challenging issue I ever have to face as a Christian defending his faith. Greg Kolka with Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
I'm completely operational and all my circuits are functioning perfectly.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel here, and I'm so glad you joined me. I appreciate all of my listeners, and I had an opportunity to meet a bunch of them in Milwaukee last week at the Evangelical Theological and Philosophical Society professional meeting and at the EPS conference there in one of the local churches, Spring Creek, I think. Met so many of our listeners and the people who use our material and read our books. It just was great. And I always enjoy going face to face. And many of you say, I think I know you. And the answer or the proper response, which I give, is you do know me. You know about me. You know about my family. You know about my vacations. You know about my kids. You know about my fishing. You know all kinds of stuff about me. I just don't know much about you. And that's the nature of this kind of one-sided relationship. But I'm happy with my part of this relationship and satisfied that I can be an encouragement and a mentor of sorts at a distance to the rest of you. So I am going to be taking your calls. I'll give you the number. It won't matter because we're full up right now. 1-800-22. No, we do have an open line. 1-800-227-5278. If you're in the 714 area code, you can dial direct 754-4150. Of course, we've got 2 hours of showtime left, so we'll probably get to you one way or another here. Part of what I did this last week, though, and sometimes it works out this way when I take this long trip and I don't have a lot of other responsibilities except for meeting people and networking and maybe going seeing some paper presentations at this professional conference, which was in Milwaukee this last week. I also sometimes take the opportunity to write because I have my hotel room and quiet and not a lot of interruption. And so I did quite a bit of writing, too, while I was out. And one of the things I was working on was the solid ground for January. So that's since holidays are coming up, I had to get it done early. And I did finish it, and it'll be going to press. But it was one of the more difficult solid grounds for me to do because of the topic matter. And indeed, it was the topic that I most hope will not come up in a public discussion. It is the topic that I pray will not come up, and I cringe when it does. And, you know, when it comes to challenges of our convictions, the problem of evil is probably the most pervasive the most annoying to other people is the exclusivity of Christ, the so-called intolerant view that Jesus is the only way. So these are singular in those regards. But one problem to me is the most awkward to try to deal with. And in fact, in the past, I have not been sure entirely how to deal with it. And I've surveyed a couple of very thoughtful assessments of it. And I think after having written about it now, I've kind of landed somewhere, and I feel comfortable. And the issue is the destruction of the Canaanites by Joshua, the apparent genocide, the apparent ethnic cleansing. And it's not just the Canaanites in the conquest, but the Amalekites also, as a bit of a side issue. This came later in 1 Samuel. And so this was another one where we read language like utterly destroy, leave no one breathing, or leave nothing breathing, or phrases like men, women, children, cattle, sheep, goats, dogs, chickens, termites. I mean, wipe them out is the sense that we get from the passage. And boy, when we read these things, there's kind of this feeling, like, say it ain't so. This looks really bad, and it is really bad. And what I don't want to do here is inappropriately sanitize a text. I want to figure out what it's talking about. Now, in the past, we've had two different people speak on this on Stand to Reason that is on the show. And both are friends of mine, colleagues, and one of them is Paul Copan, who up until just this week was the president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society, finished out his term this weekend. He actually drove me to the airport yesterday. Good man. I have so much respect for him, and blah, 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 blah. So he gave a take on it, and it's the same take that he has on in his book, Is God a Moral Monster? Now, in that book, which I highly recommend, by the way, it deals with a lot of questionable things in the Old Testament, slavery and rape and all kinds of things in the law that look odd to our 21st century perspective. But he goes back into the time and assessment and does a great job in explaining things, but he gives three chapters to the issue of the alleged genocide and ethnic cleansing, the conquest of the land, and his take on it is that what we have in these accounts are the kind of hyperbole, which is exaggeration for the sake of effect, that you normally would find in that kind of text. We have to understand the context of ancient Near Eastern military narrative, and that kind of hyperbole was common, particularly with military conquest. You can read battle reports of the time, and you see this warfare rhetoric that is throughout it, and it can't be taken at face value, just like when you read the sports page and you hear about somebody annihilating somebody else or that kind of language, you know that this is hyperbolic. And phrases like utterly destroy, put to death men, women, children, infants, other obliteration language were stock stereotypical idioms that were used, for example, even when women and children were not present. And so Paul argues that these, it ain't so. It ain't quite the way it looks. It's really an attack of conquest against the land that was primarily against military outposts, which did not have women or children present. And when the military outposts are destroyed, the people flee, and the point of the conquest was with the military aspect was to clear the land of the people and their idolatry. But there wasn't an expectation that everybody would be wiped out, because Joshua or God in Deuteronomy tells them that they are not to make alliances with these people. They are not to intermarry. And Dr. Copan reasons, well, you know, if people are wiped out, there's no sense telling them not to make alliances. They must still be there. And indeed, Joshua says at the end of his life, I've done everything that the Lord told me to do. I completely completed the job, is the way it sounds, the way he's talking. And of course, people were still there. The Canaanites were still around. So clearly, if he did what he was told and they weren't wiped out, then God did intend him to wipe them out. Well, some of you might recall a few weeks later, we had Clay Jones on, and he gave a completely different take on it. And his take was, no, God did mean it. And even though there may be hyperbolic language in the account, this was not principally a military action. And I just for your knowledge, your understanding, this is really largely the side that I come down on now. Having read carefully both arguments and looked more in detail at some of the practices of the people of the time, that is the Canaanites, who were nasty, even by ancient Near Eastern standards, they were worse than everybody else. Now, part of the problem is that when we countenance what they did, the list of crimes that they committed that God found detestable, a lot of those things are being done in our culture now, and it doesn't bring a blush to people's faces. And indeed, this is the way people respond to, this account. We look at what's said and we think, well, that's not so bad. You know, I'm looking for my list here. Divination, sexual adventure, adultery, homosexuality, transvestitism, all evil. Please, give me a break. Are you kidding? What an uptight God. Now, that wasn't the complete list, because bestiality is on the list, all sorts of beasts that were involved, and child sacrifice was on the list as well. And I'm going to read you something in a moment that comes from the documentation about what the Canaanites did, about Molech and some. And so if you've got tender ears close by, I want you to move away for a few moments. But and people might think, well, children aren't being torched on church altars nowadays. Well, that's true, but thousands die daily in abortion clinics, sacrificed. And here I'm using the term literally, and I'm using the term literally. Sacrificed on the altar to the gods of choice and convenience. These kids are being sacrificed. And all the other nasties that are on that list of the Canaanites, you can find it one click away on the internet. And again, nobody's blushing. Some people might say, well, I wouldn't do that. But it's part of our culture. Now, when God gave the directive to Joshua to cleanse the land, it became clear that these commands were not simply related to a military action. The military carried it out. But what they were carrying out was a sentence of capital punishment on a culture. Deuteronomy 9:5, it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord your God is driving them out before you. Leviticus 18:24, do not defile yourselves by any of these things that were just prohibited for the nation of Israel. For by all these things, the nations which I am casting out before you have become defiled. Deuteronomy 18, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not learn to imitate the detestable things of those nations. Because of these detestable things, the Lord your God will drive them out before you. Now, there was a reason that God had commanded, among other things, in Leviticus 18, do not give any of your children to be sacrificed to Molech. That's verse 21. So I want to read you some of the historical information about their practices, and this is where the kids have to go. Here it is. Molech was a Canaanite underworld deity represented as an upright bull-headed idol with a human body, bull's head, human body, in whose belly a fire was stoked, and in whose outstretched arms a child was placed that would be burned to death. And it was not just infants. Children as old as 4 were sacrificed. Ladies and gentlemen, Eva. Eva Ray Kokel. She's 4 years old. You want me to make this real to you? Go to my Facebook. You'll see a picture of her, 4 years old. And here's another one. A bronze image of Kronos, K-R-O-N-O-S. This is a Phoenician god. Phoenicians were Canaanite. A bronze image of Kronos was set up among them, stretching out its cupped hands above a bronze cauldron, which would burn the child. As the flame... Hold on. I lost my page. Got it. As the flame burning the child surrounded the body, the limbs would shrivel up and the mouth would appear to grin as if laughing until it was shrunk enough to slip into the cauldron. Archaeological evidence indicates that children thus burned to death sometimes numbered in the thousands. Now, I just want you to countenance that. That's all I'm going to read. The kids can come back. I just want you to imagine such a thing and a people doing such a thing. And if a people did such a thing today, what would atheists say? They would say, where was God? How could God allow something like this to happen? Well, God did allow it. He was patient, waiting, because he is abundant in loving kindness. He is slow to anger. He welcomed the alien in. The alien had the same rights that the non-alien did in the Commonwealth. The Nineveh, who is an Assyrian city, guilty of all kinds of horrendous things, when they repented, God relented. God is slow to anger. It took him nearly 500 years before he punished the Canaanites. Genesis 15. He said, Abraham, your descendants will be enslaved for 400 years. Then they will come back, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. I'm waiting. He was patient. And then he lowered the boom. Then he judged them. And I know people are upset. Wait a minute, women and children, they're non-combatants. This wasn't combat, friends. This wasn't a military action. This was capital punishment on a nation. And it was the whole nation that was involved with this. And when God deals with peoples, he usually deals with nations, especially in grand designs. When he judged the Jews, he judged the nation. When the nation was experiencing drought or attack, the whole nation got it. When the Assyrians came against the northern kingdom, and 300 years later, 200 years later, the Babylonians came against the south, they came against the whole nation because the nation was guilty. God treated the Jews the same way he treated anybody else. The nation that opposes him will be judged, and they were. And so when Joshua came in for the conquest, he was supposed to wipe the slate clean. And by the way, as for himself, he did. And here's why I think even Joshua is using hyperbolic language in some measure. He's saying, everything the Lord commanded me, I did. That is, everything that Joshua was able to do on his watch, he did just as God wanted him to do. It didn't mean the job was done yet. There were still Canaanites in the land that God said himself he would drive out slowly. The next generation, we see at the beginning of Judges, was supposed to continue the job. They did not. And when God says, wipe them out, don't make treaties with them, don't intermarry with them, he's not saying, I don't really mean wipe them out, because they'll still be here, but as they're still here, then don't make treaties or don't intermarry. He's saying, wipe them out, don't make treaties, don't intermarry, wipe them out. One is a contrast to the other. They were to clear the land of the idolatry and of the people and the culture that contributed to it, so it wouldn't infect and corrupt the theological core of Israel. Israel was the rescue plan. God's promise was through Abraham that the seed of Abraham would be a blessing to all nations. That's the Messiah. How can that happen if the nation that is to give birth to the Messiah is corrupted by idolatry? God had the well-being of the nations in view when he brought judgment on this particular nation. It wasn't ethnic cleansing. He didn't care about the skin color. It wasn't genocide. He didn't just pick out a group of people that he wanted to destroy for the sake of killing that group of people. God was concerned about sin, and he judged the sin. And in the process of judging the sin, he is clearing the land so that the nation of Israel could have a place where they can develop spiritual purity and truth that would give rise then to the blessing to all nations. And if anybody wanted to change their mind, like Rahab, come on board. How blessed is the man whose sin the Lord does not take into account. David said that, and this is true for anyone who wanted to join the Commonwealth. Was available, but people didn't want that. And consequently, they were judged. As God said during the time of Joshua, but not after. And let me just close with this. Well, I had two thoughts I want to close with quickly. And one of them is, if you follow the book of Judges, Judges is an account of the Canaanization of Israel. Where they came, they became like the people they were supposed to displace. And instead of being a light to the world, they mixed and mingled and became just like everybody else. And by the way, there's a lesson there, which is so obvious, I'm not going to belabor it for us today. And at the end of the book of Judges, it says there was no king in Israel. By the way, that would be not even God, functionally. But every man did what was right in his own eyes. They were just like everybody else. They were Canaanized. And then God brought upon Israel the same judgment he brought about on Canaan. Not right away. Hundreds of years later, through the kings, Saul, David, Solomon, through the split kingdom, Israel and Judah in the south. And in Israel in the north, 20 kings, not a single king was good. That was Ahab, and that was Jezebel, and all their lot. And God was patient, and he finally lowered the boom eventually on them. See, the lesson of the conquest is that God judges evil. And eventually, he judges all evil. And if there's not repentance, if there's not a change, if there's not a beating of the heart, then God will have his justice. And there's no escaping it. And that's the lesson we have to take away from it. And the reason that we're so offended when we read this text of God delivering judgment on people who deserved it is that, as Clay Jones has pointed out, We just don't hate sin like God does. We're used to it. And I think there's a tendency to try to sanitize God a little bit in this. Oh, he didn't mean it quite like that. No, he meant it. Yes, there's some hyperbole. That's true of every narrative, ancient and modern. But literary devices are always meant to clarify meaning, not obscure it, friends. And God's clear message was that punishment was coming, and it would be poured out with a fury upon all the inhabitants of a deeply corrupt nation that had reveled in its debauchery for centuries. So, we have nothing to apologize for with the conquest. And there I stand. And January 1, you'll get the full rendering of it coming out in Solid Ground. All right, your call's coming up after this. I'm Greg Kokel.
In the United States, over 51 million abortions have been performed since it was legalized in 1973. That's one abortion every 26 seconds. If you have been wanting to be able to speak out effectively against abortion, or just be better prepared to discuss this often heated and always emotional topic, STR has a great resource to help equip you to do that. Stand to Reason Interactive, Making Abortion Unthinkable, prepares you for any pro-life encounter, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with the confidence that your case is solid, your knowledge deep, and your argument just. Created to be used as a personal study or in a small group setting in your church or home, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned, plug-and-play course provides the basic training for anyone to become proficient in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through video, workbooks, role-playing, and quizzes, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to restore meaning to the word abortion using compelling visual aids, simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, present scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric, clear the red herring objections, and stay on course. Be respectful toward the person you're talking with. If you haven't yet taken a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at str.org.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. When we read the Gospels or one of Paul's letters, can we be confident that 2,000 years later we have what they originally wrote? The answer is a clear yes, and all we have to do is point to the facts. Find out what those facts are in my Bulletproof podcast this month. Look for Bulletproof on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Is God just a crutch? Was Jesus a fraud? Are science and faith antithetical? Christian apologist and philosopher Greg Kokel applies his trademark clear thinking to these and other vexing issues facing believers today in Faith Is Not Wishing, 13 Essays for Christian Ambassadors. Through this thoughtful approach, Greg demonstrates that Christian faith is not wishful thinking, but rather a sure conviction grounded in evidence. Visit Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org to get a copy of Faith Is Not Wishing, or call 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800-2-REASON.
Stand to Reason, and I'm your host, Greg Kokel, giving you a piece of my mind today. If you've lost your mind, you can find me right here on Stand to Reason every weekend. Let's see. I had made a comment last hour, for those listening, about a list of moral, objective moral rules, in a sense, that were seen to be common among all cultures that C.S. Lewis had compiled. I think this is in the back, the appendix of The Abolition of Man. So for those of you who were wondering to what I was referring, there you have it. Although Bill Craig made a point once that just because William Lane Craig, the philosopher, just because some people are confused about what is right and what is wrong doesn't mean that we have to be skeptical. If torturing babies for fun, rape, murdering human beings, a whole host of other things we can list as seem to be obvious moral wrongs are things that some people will contest. Well, I don't know why it's wrong. Why should I be shaken from my confidence in the moral wrongness of that just because somebody else is confused. So anyway, there's something for you. Let's go to New York City, and let me find my button here. Hello, Stephen. Welcome to the show. Greg Kokel.
Hi.
Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hi. My question is about atheism and logic.
Okay.
We all know that, you know, contemporary atheists like to pride themselves on how reasonable, how logical they are.
Yes.
But I've actually been noticing a sort of shift away from that and towards the opposite, because I've talked to a lot of atheists, and I've heard this from people, for example, that Bill Craig has debated, such as Lawrence Krauss,
yes,
who have actually said things to the effect of, you know, logic is not going to work because the universe is not a logical place. So if we investigate it logically, we're going to come to wrong conclusions.
I'm chuckling because he has to employ the basic laws of logic to even make such a statement.
Yeah, I think that's the exact response Bill Craig gave to that as well.
Uh-huh.
But
it's just obviously true. You know, one wonders why he doesn't think this way. He is going to fault all kinds of other things in his own field, bad conclusions by other scientists. He's going to say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't follow from the evidence. You know, when he's not protecting turf here, he's just with his other colleagues talking about something completely unrelated to God. He'll say, well, that isn't supported by the evidence. That's not a reasonable or rational thing to do. He will employ all of these things, not just subconsciously, but consciously to make particular points. So how is it that the rules are now changed when it comes to this issue? This is special pleading. Pardon me for raising an informal fallacy in this circumstance, but it's special pleading. And it's an example of irrationality itself.
Yeah, and my question was, do you notice this as well? Do you notice this shift away from logic and rationality for atheists towards an embracement of irrationality? Do you think there will ever be a time where atheists will say, yeah, you know, if you think about this stuff logically, you're going to come to the conclusion that God exists, but the problem is you're thinking about it logically, and that's a religious thing, because that doesn't work in our universe. We have to be scientists, so we can't. Do you think that this shift is going to happen?
No,
I
would be surprised if that particular thing happened, because what you're saying is that, well, the atheist community, by and large, do what apparently Lawrence Krauss has done and said, you can't trust reason. Now, I know that the mathematician from Cambridge there, Stephen Hawking, has said as much in his book last year or the year before on the grand design. And he embraced a kind of non-realism when it came to understanding the world. And it's a very postmodern kind of approach, which does reject reason. But the irony is that he does the same as others who reject reason. He's employing reason all along. His book was so thick with contradiction. It was almost made the mind reel to read it here. And this is one of the smartest men in the world by common assessment, and Stephen Hawking. And he's kind of embraced, at least he says he embraced this kind of Kantian non-realism, and I do not think this will be characteristic of atheists ongoing, because most of them are deeply committed to an Enlightenment view of the universe. The Enlightenment view is that reason reigns supreme, and even though once in a while you're going to get some people that just get silly, like Krauss and Hawking on this issue. And I say silly because I think the view is silly, and I don't think they really believe it. When you look at the way they do their discipline and even the way they write their books and stuff, they don't follow through on these things. They are not consistent in their view. And so I don't think most people are going to follow that. So these guys get a little silly sometimes. They sell a couple of books, fine. The rank-and-file atheist is not going to champion non-reason. However, I do think that atheists do frequently embrace irrationality in that they embrace conclusions that are not consistent with reason. These are the champions of reason, and they end up believing unreasonable things, like something can come from nothing. Now, this is not a reasonable belief. It is completely inconsistent with all of our experience. It defies the first law of thermodynamics. We know of no... We never appeal to something coming from nothing for the appearance of anything in the universe, but when push comes to shove, they appeal to the appearance of the universe in that sense. Now, when Krauss says this, something from nothing, he's not using words carefully because he doesn't mean nothing in the philosopher's sense, which is universal negation. He means quantum vacuum. And everything comes from the quantum vacuum with the laws of gravity somehow working on it. But the quantum vacuum isn't nothing. So he's cheating a little bit by using his words equivocally, and that confuses people. But atheists do want to opt for something coming from nothing rather than something coming from something. When it comes to the origin of the universe, because something coming from something sounds too much like God. And so they're going to opt for the irrational thing. And I make this point with an illustration, Stephen, and then I'll have to move on. But the illustration is just knocking on the door. Just, I don't know if you can hear that or not.
Yeah, I can hear it.
There you go. So when you hear a knock on the door, what is your impulse? What does reason suggest to you? That is, what is the appropriate conclusion? What is the appropriate deliverance of reason? Well, that knock did not knock itself, but rather someone else is responsible, especially if it's like this, you know, that kind of thing. Well, there's intelligent design there. So the atheist is going to get up and he's going to answer the door, because even though it might be possible, I don't think it is, but if I accepted within the realm of possibility, the knock could knock itself. It's not likely. It's not plausible. It's not reasonable. And that's why they answer the door. By the same token, even if I were to admit that something could come from nothing, that the dictum ex nihilo nihilo fit, that is, from nothing, nothing comes, is not an absolute. Well, even so, it doesn't mean it's reasonable to believe that something can come from nothing. It's always more reasonable to believe that something comes from something else that's adequate to explain it. And that's the essence of the cosmological argument, which is rejected by atheists. So it seems to me that atheists are being irrational at that particular point. And I don't know how they can get around that. They are opting for the irrational option that the knock knocked itself, that the Big Bang banged itself. And Krauss isn't going to rescue them from that. He doesn't have an answer for that. He doesn't have an answer for the ultimate beginning even of the quantum vacuum. So anyway, Stephen, there you go. And I hope that was got you thinking. I think atheists are frequently irrational in the conclusions they come to. Since we're tight on the break here, let's go early to the break, and then we'll come back with Seattle and Knoxville, Tennessee, and the rest of you who have questions on Stand to Reason.
Call today to request the latest issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you represent your faith, even when discussing the most timely and heated subjects like evolution, cloning, stem cell research, and doctor-assisted suicide. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will teach you how to represent your faith as an ambassador for Christ in a concise and attractive manner. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org to request our newsletter, Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free when you call 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org.
Is science the only way we can discover knowledge? It turns out that not only are there other ways, some are more immediate and accurate than science. Find out what they are in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Find it on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Did God really say, it's the oldest temptation in human history, one that targets the authority of God's word at its very foundation? Its modern rephrasing takes many forms, both in academia and in popular culture. Are the New Testament documents reliable? Have ancient biblical books been lost or suppressed by the early church? Are the words of the Bible just flawed human inventions? These questions introduce doubt at the point of contact between God and man, undermining the Christian's confidence in the words of Scripture. Even those secure in their affirmation of divine authorship must wrestle with similar questions. Did God really say to me? In other words, do the promises of Scripture apply to the individual Christian's life today or only to those originally addressed? How is one to understand and apply these biblical assurances? In this timely collection of essays called Ancient Words, Reflections on the Reliability and Proper Use of Scripture, Greg carefully addresses each of these issues, providing both solid evidence for the reliability of Scripture and a clear roadmap for how it should be read and applied. Greg's responses to these popular challenges to biblical authority will help reinforce your confidence in this trustworthy book. Go to Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org and get a copy of Ancient Words or call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason.
Reasonable, sensible, fair discussion. That's what I promise you here every weekend, Sundays, 2 to 5 on Stand to Reason. Now, some of you don't get the show for 3 hours. You only get 2 hours of the show. By the way, that was Los Angeles time, and I know those in other markets are time warped. I mentioned the time, though, for our massive army of podcast listeners who are not listening live at all and are calling in based on the live time. So I have to give you the LA times, 2 to 5. And if you're a podcast listener, you can call me during that time. And I'd be glad to take your calls, 1-800-227-5278. Of course, line's pretty full now, so let's go back to Saski in Seattle. Hello, Saski.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, nice to hear from you.
Very nice to hear from you. Hey, before I start, I always like to compliment you. And I just want to say I've been thinking lately how much of an impact you've had on my life personally. And not only thinking as a Christian, but just thinking, period. Like, it's... Honestly, you are an amazing teacher, and this should be taught in public schools, in my opinion. Of course, that'll never happen. But
well, you are very kind. I deeply appreciate that.
Yeah.
By the way, did you know I was in Seattle last weekend?
Yes, I did, and I let myself know the week before I was going to try and get out to see you, and then I heard you talking about it, and I was like, crap, I forgot he was out.
Yeah, well, I was in Snohomish, and that's up there by Everett, so it's,
I would drive to the other side of the state to come see you, so that, yeah. And Snohomish is very nice, though.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thanks.
Next time we're out, I'll have to catch you.
Yeah, but I was going to thank you for the kind words, though. That's what I meant. So what's on your mind today, Saski?
So I've been in, like, a mini conversation with just some people on the Internet over at Reasonable Faith, William Lane Craig's, some of his current events vlogs. There'll be a little discussion. And I was talking to largely other Christians, people I think were genuine followers of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And the issue was on, I think it was the exit polls, and the discussion, of course, got to abortion. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to another believer who voted for Obama, and I was just trying to, you know, gather, given our current president's disgusting, you know, abortion record. Mm-hmm. I was just discussing with him, like, in my opinion, and I guess the reason I'm calling is to, I don't ever want to come off as too, speaking too, I don't know, boldly or arrogantly, but it seems to me that it would be hard to justify voting for someone with that kind of record, regardless of how good they are in other areas.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously he's pushing back because he doesn't agree with me on that. And the conversation wasn't violent or heated or anything, but I guess it just, what I have trouble understanding is how it could possibly be that another issue could outweigh abortion.
Yes, well, did you ask him that question?
I did, and actually I even gave the analogy of, well, let's just say the president authorized the termination for whatever reason, X reasons, of homosexuals. Like, it's doesn't matter what the people group is. It's wrong.
Yes, right. But it's fair to, you know, use kind of a political hot button with homosexuals here. Yes, let's just say that the policy, not just the policy that he believed in, but the policy that was in play that he supported. So this isn't just an abstract, like maybe sometime down the line. This is the policy, that not only will he supports, but he would ensure is in place in perpetuity, you know, by the, say, the Supreme Court justices that he selects. And this policy that we're talking about is that every day 3,000 homosexuals were executed.
Mm-hmm.
Every day 3,000 homosexuals. And, of course, you'd run out of homosexuals after a while.
Right.
Well, then you'd have to pick some other group, you know.
Uh-huh.
Then 3,000 Chinese or 3,000 mm-hmm. Filipinos or 3,000 illegal aliens or something, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you put it that way, and they say what?
When I put it that way, it was almost as if he didn't see that sentence. And I don't know if he was just caught up in his own train of thought, and I can respect that if he just skipped over it. I don't see how you could if that was I would say it was the main thrust of my argument. But he went on to talk about how basically his argument was that everything poverty, because he was emphasizing the president's emphasis on the poor, I guess, and helping the poor, and he was saying, you know, poverty causes death and so on and so on. And I granted, you know, in some cases,
poverty does not
death.
Cause death in this country. You know?
Right. And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I mean, I'm just breaking in a little bit because I get disgusted with these kinds of comparisons.
Right.
You
right.
know, in the abstract, poverty causes death. And I'm not saying that no individual dies here from this. But the problem in this country is not poverty. That isn't
right.
the Now, I know what people say, and I heard this on both sides of the ledger. 1/6 of the people in this country are in poverty. You cannot – this is a meaningless statistic unless you have a clear definition of what they mean by poverty. If you don't know what the standard is that they're measuring by, then this is meaningless. And of course, they never tell you. And it turns out when you find out the standard, this is not a helpful way of assessing things. Okay?
No, it isn't. And even the way they would consider poverty, I'm pretty sure I would be considered poor when I'm living on a little, but I'm living just fine.
Yes, there's another question. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Continue.
Because then you have to ask, even if you granted them, yes, poverty is killing. Is it killing 3,000 people a day?
Yes, and actually I said, granted that, okay, let's just assume that, because I was trying to be as charitable towards him as possible in an effort to help him to think a little clearer. I was saying, let's just grant that poverty causes some death through poverty, crime, and so on.
Right.
I said, in the case of abortion, 99.9% of the time, abortion will always lead to death.
Yeah, more than that. And by the way, poverty doesn't cause crime, period. That's
another
one of those disgusting distortions. You know, during the Depression, crime rate dropped precipitously. It's not poverty that causes crime. It's bad values that cause crime.
Right. I wish I would have known that during the discussion.
Yeah, it's just this is a leftist bromide that's just false.
Mm-hmm.
And it just drives me crazy. Okay, if poverty causes crime, the solution then is to give poor people money, and the more you give poor people money, the more crime will drop. Has that happened?
Right.
No, it hasn't.
Definitely.
I mean, this is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
You find a criminal and you give him money.
And
you find him and you
crime.
Ask, and then you see whether he stops his crime. It's just so obviously false. So the other issue here, and these are all matter of fact, it presumes also that if you give poor people money, that's what the government wants to do. This is how we help the poor. We're going to give poor people money. That this will help their poverty. It doesn't. It exacerbates it. The best way to get people out of poverty is a free market. And, I mean, this is a longer discussion. I can't go into it now. But there are assumptions that people who are involved here are making. And they're thinking that welfare helps solve poverty, and welfare encourages it and increases it. Just chart it from LBJ and the Great Society right on down. When you give people money who are in tough situations, look, you give people money for doing nothing and it corrupts their soul, period. This is a standard, it's a rule of nature. It's a law of physics. And it increases the problem. It doesn't increase the solution. So it sounds nice. It sounds like we're really helping people because we're giving them something. We're not. There's other solutions to this. They're a little more hard-nosed, but they result in less poverty, however you want to describe that term. And it is largely a free market. And there are all kinds of problems with the approach that the friends that you have talked to about this have taken. And that is their political philosophy is all ups in their economics are upside down and backwards. But even if you accept all of that stuff, you still have a guaranteed 3,000 people a day killed through abortion.
Right. Right.
And so how are you going to count? How does that compare to anything else?
Absolutely. And I even brought up to him, he wants to, you know, so-called help the poor, but at the same time, he's killing half of the poor people who could even come into the world. And I was just trying to show him, like, and I guess this goes back to my primary question, like, how could you stack, do you think that under any circumstances you could stack any other political or moral issue
against
abortion?
That. Now, of course, we're assuming that the person that you're talking with is already pro-life.
Yes, he was. He stated explicitly he does think abortion
Well, you know what? I heard a funny thing got sent to me in the email recently, and I usually don't read these things, but this one was pretty clever. And it does deal with this economic issue. And this was I'm just going to say left and right here instead of political parties because I don't want to make it too partisan. But you'll be able to see how this plays out. A woman went over to a friend's house who were left of center, and their child said she wanted 7-year-old or 8-year-old, 9-year-old, whatever. Well, I want to be when I grow up, I want to be president. And the woman said, "Well, what's the first thing you'll do when you're president?" And he said, the child said, "I'm going to feed all the homeless, and I'm going to give houses and food to all the homeless and all the hungry." And of course, the parents were beaming proudly at the statement. And then the woman said to the boy, "Well, you know, you don't have to wait to become president to do that. I have some yard work that needs to be done at my house. You can come over to my house, and you can work. I'll give you $10 an hour to pull weeds and trim hedges, and then after you're done working, you can take that money over to the homeless person that's right down the road from you here." And the little boy thought about that for a minute, and he says, "Well, why don't you just have the homeless person come over to your house and trim your hedges and pull your weeds?" And she said, "Well, welcome to the right side of the political spectrum," is what she said in so many words. But it's brilliant. It's just it shows the common sense. I wonder if your friend, you could ask your friend, and I'm going to have to run here in a few moments, but I wonder if you asked your friends who said, "I want to help the poor." That's what he said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Said,
yeah, he did, absolutely.
Tell me what, apart from what you think your vote is going to accomplish, because I don't think that vote was, in fact, a vote for the good for the poor. Because what poor people need are jobs. And incidentally, one person made the comment, "Tell me, how many jobs do poor people give to other people?" You know, it's rich people who make jobs, you know, so you should make it easier for rich people to make jobs. Then poor people can get jobs, you know, that's what they need. But I just wonder, ask this person, apart from his vote, what is he doing for the poor? What is he doing for the poor? How deep is he reaching in his pocket to help these people? And I don't mean if he's giving $2 to the guy in the corner, you know, who's got a sign up and he drives by and when it's red light, he gives him $2. That's nothing. That's a pittance. If that makes him feel good about himself, then his conscience is not sensitive enough. What is he doing besides electing somebody who's going to take somebody else's money and redistribute it? What is that person doing for the poor if he's so concerned? And this is where, you know, in that illustration, this woman's question comes back. You don't have to wait to be president, or you don't have to wait to vote for president before you can help the poor. You can do something right now, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, my suspicion is that most of these people who want to help the poor by casting a ballot in the way that your friends were casting it, don't want to do anything themselves.
Yep.
They don't want to spend their money or their time. They want to spend somebody else's money and somebody else's time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they think is noble, morally noble. So it may be that your friend is given to charity in some way, shape, or form. I don't know. But that would be the question to ask.
I think I will, because the conversation is still ongoing. So.
Okay, well, good. By the way, Jay Richards has written a book called something like God, Capitalism, and the Poor, or something like that. Jay,
Was it
2 years ago, I'd say,
and
a half. But it's a good read. And his argument there, you know who Jay Richards is. You might know who he is. He's the Privileged Planet guy. He was with the Discovery.
Oh, okay. I've heard of Privileged Planet.
He was with the Discovery Institute. He went to the Acton Institute. Now he's back with Discovery. But in any event, he took this foray into private enterprise, and he did a lot of good work on it and wrote this book. And, excuse me, in this book, he makes the case that if you care about the poor, you'll be a capitalist. And you will try to encourage the creation of jobs, because the creation of wealth helps the poor. And that's the way to get the poor out of poverty, is not to give them money and food stamps and all of that other stuff. It's to get them off of those things.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best thing for their economic circumstance, and it's the best thing for their souls. But if we have a system that encourages indolence, and that's what the system does. I know there are people down and out and all that, but look, at hard cases don't make good policy. That's a general rule there, you know, for politics. You take a hard case, you can't make policy on it. You got to ask, what is the impact of the policy across the board on people's lives? And is this going to encourage indolence, or is it going to encourage thrift and hard work? And on balance, the welfare system in its many forms encourages indolence in our culture. And that just exacerbates, which means makes more problematic the problem. So but that's something apparently your friend does not understand, because he's never read a book on economics.
Mm-hmm.
So
I appreciate the conversation, and hopefully I'll be able to check in again with the results of the conversation.
All right. Be glad to do that. I thank you for your call,
Saskia.
Yeah, it's always good to reflect on these issues, because they're really important. Okay, 2 hours down and one to go. Line's pretty much full up. I plan to jump right in to calls when I return, because so many people want to chat. You've been listening to Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel. Our final hour here on Stand to Reason. I am Greg Kokel. Almost couldn't get that out. But I stopped in the middle, because when I said I, of course, then I thought, well, it's not always of course, because I'm not always the guy behind the mic here. But I am now behind the mic, taking your calls, 1-800-227-5278. This our final hour of Stand to Reason. As I mentioned last hour, instead of opening with some comments here, I thought I'd just jump right into the calls, because many of you have been waiting for a while. So let's do that. Let's go to Knoxville, Tennessee, and John. Hi, John.
Hey, Greg. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm getting a little bit of a scratchy throat, which I thought, well, this is great. I just got back from a week of work. I got a holiday coming up that I can rest and relax, and I'm probably going to spend it with a sniffle. But that's the way it works. What's on your mind today, John?
Well, my roommate and I are both students at the University of Tennessee, and we're both Christians who love apologetics, and we're probably the only two people that we know that are actually interested in apologetics at all. Like, our other Christian friends really don't see much of a point in apologetics and intellectual thinking about faith. I mean, they all tend to think that you just need to have faith and then read your Bible and you'll be okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do need to have faith. I mean, that's important. But if they're saying if you just need to crank up this feeling of faith in order to deal with the onslaught of challenges, it's just not going to be enough.
Oh, I agree.
You know that, right?
What we're told. But to combat this, he and I have taken it upon ourselves to start a Ratio Christi chapter here on our university campus. As it is right now, we have a chapter director and maybe two people that come semi-regularly. And I guess right now we're excited because we'd like to, I guess, get the word out more about apologetics.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he and I are both kind of like, where do we go from here? I mean, we're just two kids, you know,
right,
who like to read. I mean, we confront people who are apathetic just about every day, both from the Christian side and from the secular side.
Mm-hmm.
So we're both kind of just bewildered on how to, you know, not just approach individual people in our lives, but the campus as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is a good strategic way to use the platform that we have to further the cause of Christ via apologetics, not just you know, ministry events or concerts or whatever, but really getting up and saying Christianity is not just good, but it's true.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, that's a good question, and I'm not entirely sure how best to answer. The first, as you were talking initially, the first thing I was thinking was, how do you build your own numbers? And that is that the first thing on your to-do list ought to be to expand the size of your group. So in a sense, let's think of it like a military operation. So you have, I'm always a little uncomfortable using military metaphors, but they're just so apt, it seems to me. So we know we're not talking about combat here with people. We're talking about strategizing how to reach people that we care about. But so we're not talking about D-Day, but more diplomacy in our style. But that aside, you do have a region you want to conquer in a certain sense, or at least have an impact on. And so in order to do that, you have to have an army of one or two people. You know, that's not even a squad. So I would say the first order of business is to build your ranks, and that is ranks of kindred spirits, people that understand the need for apologetics, or at least are open to the possibility and to the need, and then band together with you for a like-minded cause. Okay?
Okay,
so that's the first thing. So before you can kind of assault the campus and say, let's show them that Christianity is worth thinking about, that it's true, and all this other thing, that's a grander design. You've got to have a basic group. You know, did you see the Band of Brothers, the movie, or the HBO special?
I have not, no.
Oh. Well, these are the guys that land on D-Day, and they follow this company through the entire war. But the first couple of episodes is all their training, how they get the guys and how they train them in Georgia, Kurahei, Georgia, whatever, and then they send them overseas and whatever. But you got to recruit, you got to train. So I would, if I were you, that's the first thing that I'd think about: recruiting and training. How do you find people of kindred spirit? Now you might begin attending Christian organizations of on campus. I don't know if you've got a crusade or a crew, I guess is what they call themselves now, or you have
a. It's actually funny you bring that up, because that's actually the first problem we run into, is trying to find people who are like-minded in that regard. Because, like, my roommate and I met through a mutual friend at a Christian ministry on our campus. We know quite a few people from different ministries on campus. Our biggest issue is that people that are our friends that are Christians really just don't care. Mm-hmm. Like, we've talked to ministers as well as students, and the response is almost universal. Apologetics does not matter. The intellectual arguments do not matter. Mm. All you need to do is love on people. Ugh. That's what it's all about.
Okay, what distinguishes, here's a question, what distinguishes them from Mormons? I mean, you can't out-nice a Mormon. If you want to be nice to people and love on people and all that, you can't beat Mormons, taken as a whole. So what distinguishes us from Mormons? I mean, this is the question I would ask pastors or any Christian who offers that. I understand that this is your difficulty, and I can see how this is a huge problem in your community. But I have just got to believe, even though it may be slim pickings, that there are people like you out there, maybe people who have been assaulted by others, you know, intellectually, either by other students or in classes. Again, if it were me in your shoes, the first thing that I would be looking to do is to find those of kindred spirit and have something quasi-organized to be able to draw them into. Like you could say, we meet on Tuesday nights, and there's only three of us right now, but we're going through this book, or we're going through this video. So you have a core that gathers on a regular basis for something. So you have, when you run across the person who, you said they're few and far between, but there's got to be some, when you run across that person, you've got something that you can give them to do, a way of kind of joining your fellowship. Uh-huh. And so if you get together for lunch or whatever it is, and you say, well, we're getting together with you, you know, you're going to join our group, our band of, our small band of brothers and sisters, as the case may be. So, and I would make it an issue of consistent and persistent prayer. God, give us those people. Give us those brothers and sisters that understand that that loving on them isn't enough, that we have to do like Paul did time and time and time again in the book of Acts, Acts 16, Acts 17, Acts 18, Acts 19. He met with them, he reasoned with them, and some were persuaded. You want to find people that understand that that is part of what we need to do, and you ask God to bring them to you. And then you go out and you beat the pavement. You keep looking. I wish I could give you some clever thing, like here is the trick way to attract them all, but I think it's just going to be more than anything else hard work. Talking
right.
to people, you know, testing their spirit, seeing if they are familiar with any of this stuff, if they see the need for this, we're doing this stuff, we want to invite you or whatever, and build your cadre from there, little by little, that you're going to have something like a critical mass, I think, before an organization like Ratio Christi. And I saw the Ratio Christi guys just a couple of days ago, Rick and his buddies, you know, day before yesterday I saw them. So in Milwaukee, they're doing great work, and now they got more than 100 campuses. But you're going to probably have a critical mass before they're going to show up and kind of lend some support to what you're doing. You're going to have a...
Absolutely.
Pardon me?
I said absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So that's your first step. You know what you have to do. You don't have to worry about being clever now and how to reach the world for Christ or your campus. You don't have any group to reach them with. What you want to get right now is to build a squad of get your band of brothers, brethren.
I mean,
sister.
I agree with that 100%. The only thing is, it is discouraging at times because, like, My roommate, the guy that I'm doing Ratio Christi with, is the first guy in about a year and a half that I run into that actually did respond with, oh, that makes sense, this is good. Everyone else has said this is not even worth it.
Okay, you need to get a list. I'm brainstorming here a little bit. You get together with your buddy and you get a list, and you make a list of every Christian organization on campus and every evangelical church within striking distance of the campus.
Okay.
Then you start hanging out, poking around, going to services, asking questions, talking to people. Ask the pastor, do you have anything like this? You have people that come up and ask you questions. You ask the pastor, do you have people that ask you questions about these issues? If you have anybody that asks a question about these issues, you have them give us a call. Because I know pastors encounter this. Now, I mean, in some environments, it may not be that as many. In Pentecostal environments, for example, are less likely to have people. I'm just making an observation here, and I was in a charismatic church for 25 years.
That's where we're at right now.
Well, that makes it much more difficult. So find the Presbyterian church in town. Find the Lutheran church in town. Find the EV Free church in town. Find churches that are not so given to emotionalism. I'm telling you, the people are out there. You're in your particular religious community, the pickings are slimmer than most. I'm sorry to say. But you're looking at the larger, broader community here now because you want to make a difference on your campus, so you're going to draw from a larger group. Make a list of the churches, go to the Yellow Pages and start working. And now you've got some ideas of some places to go to see if there's anybody there who thinks like you.
Okay.
So you're just think of it as a military enterprise, you know. What are your steps that you're going to do? And brainstorm and pray. Ask God to bring those people to you. I know they're there. There are all kinds of Christians that are frustrated. And when we started nearly 20 years ago now, we would have people come to us and they said, oh, my gosh, I didn't know that we could do this, that we could think like this, that we could have enterprises like this. I thought it was just faith, you know, and faith in the leap of faith variety, just feeling. I didn't realize. And so I never felt completely comfortable at the churches I've been in. And I'm so glad to come to your events. Now, that was 20 years ago when we were getting started. Things have changed a lot since then for the better. And there's this huge groundswell, generally speaking. And so I've got to believe that the need is there among many Christians. They're feeling it. They just don't know you exist yet, and you don't know they exist yet, and you just got to get more visible.
Right, just putting the work in, then. That makes a lot of sense.
That's right. This idea, by the way, of going to every pastor in your evangelical community and even to the ministry leaders, like Crew and whatever other group, InterVarsity, whatever, and say, look, this is what we are pursuing. Here's our card number, email address, whatever. When somebody comes to you with an issue, please have them call us. We want to help you do your job better. That's what you tell a pastor. We want to help you do your job better. You may not get a lot of questions like this. What about this? What about that? Challenges, intellectual type challenges, evolution. Why is Jesus the only way? The problem of evil, whatever. Then you may feel like you're not really up to it. Well, you're not going to be up to it, entirely. This is, you get up to it by dealing with it, you know, by jumping in and having at it. You tell pastors and people in your community that you're available to help them do your job, their job better. Send you those people, ask questions. Then you're going to start finding people that are kindred spirits. And any other things you can think of, you know, brainstorm and pray. Ask God for this. All right, John?
Yes. All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay.
That.
I'm expecting a call in about 6 months, all right? You tell me your progress.
Guaranteed.
All right, John. Thanks for your call. Lots of people ask me, how do we do this? And there's no easy answer to that. I wish I had this little recipe. The stuff I offered John, I just thought up kind of on the spur of the moment. It's not a bad idea what I offered, but every situation is a little different. But I am convinced that there are Christians out there struggling with these things. They don't know how to answer these questions. They don't know that there are answers for these questions. I run into these people all the time when they discover us. Gee, I just realized I missed an opportunity. John is in Knoxville, Tennessee. He's at, what, the University of Tennessee or whatever in Knoxville. He can't be the only person in Knoxville, Tennessee that listens to this radio show. I wish I would have gotten a little bit more information, so those of you who are listening within striking distance, what an idiot I am. What could be more obvious? John, if you want to text, like go on Twitter or something like that, or get us a message about how people can get in touch with you, I'll mention it here on the air. Knoxville, Tennessee. I know we got listeners in Knoxville. Well, I don't know. Yes, I know we do. We got John and his buddy. But I bet you there's more. So that's one way to get the word out, and you guys can collect together with John and see what you can do on that campus. Okay, we're going to go to break here just a bit early, and then we'll be back with your calls on Stan Teresen.
In the United States, over 51 million abortions have been performed since it was legalized in 1973. That's one abortion every 26 seconds. If you have been wanting to be able to speak out effectively against abortion, or just be better prepared to discuss this often heated and always emotional topic, STR has a great resource to help equip you to do that. Stand to Reason Interactive Making Abortion Unthinkable prepares you for any pro-life encounter, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with the confidence that your case is solid, your knowledge deep, and your argument just. Created to be used as a personal study or in a small group setting in your church or home, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned, plug-and-play course provides the basic training for anyone to become proficient in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through video, workbooks, role-playing, and quizzes, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to restore meaning to the word abortion using compelling visual aids, simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, present scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric, clear the red herring objections, and stay on course. Be respectful toward the person you're talking with. If you haven't yet taken a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at str.org.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. When we read the Gospels or one of Paul's letters, can we be confident that 2,000 years later we have what they originally wrote? The answer is a clear yes, and all we have to do is point to the facts. Find out what those facts are in my Bulletproof podcast this month. Look for Bulletproof on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Is God just a crutch? Was Jesus a fraud? Are science and faith antithetical? Christian apologist and philosopher Greg Kokel applies his trademark clear thinking to these and other vexing issues facing believers today in Faith is Not Wishing, 13 Essays for Christian Ambassadors. Through this thoughtful approach, Greg demonstrates that Christian faith is not wishful thinking, but rather a sure conviction grounded in evidence. Visit Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org to get a copy of Faith is Not Wishing, or call 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800-2-REASON.
Kokel back at you here on Stand to Reason, and let's get right back to the folks here. Tarzana, California. Hello, Lou. Welcome to Stand to Reason.
Oh, hi, Greg. It's always a pleasure to listen to your broadcast. I learned something new each time.
Thank you. Good.
I've had one or two other believers come up to me and ask me about suicide and salvation. Mm-hmm. Apparently, their view is if a believer commits suicide for whatever reason, that there's an impact on their salvation, or they can lose their salvation. I happen to hold an opposite view, which I believe is biblical, but I could be mistaken.
Well, let me ask a question. Here's one that I might offer to those people, and the question is: does the blood of Christ cancel out sin, or does sin cancel out the blood of Christ? Which is stronger? Is sin stronger?
The blood of Christ, of course, cancels out.
Well, this would be your answer, and it would be my answer.
Yes.
But on their view, it seems to me they're essentially arguing that sin cancels out the blood of Christ.
Right.
So how is that the case? How is it that sin is stronger than the blood of Christ? I thought the blood of Christ is the thing that comes and cancels out sin. Now, is suicide a sin? What do you think?
Well, suicide is a violation of the one of the Ten Commandments.
I agree.
Not murder, either homicide, someone else, or suicide, killing yourself. But it's always been my understanding that all sin has been forgiven by the grace of God and Jesus' sacrifice on the cross.
I'm with you there. I do think suicide is a sin, but the question is the sin covered? Is any look at Christians who are people who are Christians are still sinners. They continue to sin until the last breath that they take. And if there's any question about this in anybody's mind, think of the two greatest commandments: love your Lord your God with all your whole, with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Now, I have never kept the first commandment, ever. And I have almost never kept the second commandment. So of the two greatest commandments, I am continually in violation of them. Mm-hmm. Yet I throw myself upon the mercy of God provided in Jesus so that I can be forgiven. My understanding of the gospel, the good news, is that I am when I throw myself on God's mercy in virtue of Christ, I am forgiven. And if anybody's not sure of that, just reread Hebrews chapter 10, which is the whole thing is about the final sacrifice once for all. Now, this brings us to the question. If, for your friends, if one throws themselves on the mercy of Christ to be forgiven of sin, and we know that even after we've done that, we continue to sin all the time, even though we are trying to get better and working by the grace of God, etc., though we still sin all the time, we are trusting in the blood of Christ to cancel out that sin. How is it then that a sin is big enough to cancel out the blood of Christ? Rationale, do we get that?
Yeah, I think their contention is, which they may be confused, is because this would be the last sin that a believer could commit.
Well, that's true. Why does that matter?
Well, because because their contention is, well, if you don't ask God for forgiveness, then you can't be forgiven of that sin.
But I did ask God for forgiveness.
Right.
I did on September 28, 1973.
Right. And, I mean, all sin is forgiven, past, present, and future. I understand that. But because of the impact of this particular deed, I think that's why they reason that way.
But
I'm not sure about their upbringing.
Right.
Because I was brought up in a Roman Catholic church. Mm-hmm. And in a parochial school system, I was taught, they did talk about suicide. And it was said that suicide had an impact on a person's salvation.
Well, that's because forgiveness is provisional in their view. And
I was raised
Catholic as well. But
and
this is one reason that I'm not a Roman Catholic, because I don't think that's an accurate view of the nature of forgiveness.
Right.
And I know, by the way, I'm role-playing, in a sense, some of my responses in this, I know that you agree with me. I'm offering some ways that you can respond and challenge their thinking. Okay, so that's the reason I'm tossing this stuff out. So they need to answer the question: why does it matter that it's the last act? Well, you didn't ask for forgiveness. Well, I didn't ask for forgiveness for most of my sins. Individual sins, and neither have they. They haven't asked for forgiveness for every sin they've committed today. They can try to sum it up at the end of the day and say they're sorry, but there's a ton of them they're going to miss. Forgiveness is not dependent on me asking forgiveness.
That's right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, because the act on the cross has already done that, we really don't have to ask for the forgiveness, because the forgiveness is already there.
Yes, I think we have to address the issue of sin in our life day to day. I think there's a propriety to that, but I do not believe that we have to ask for forgiveness to get forgiven day to day. Because if that were the case, like I said, we'd be in big trouble. We've sinned so much more than we could ever ask for forgiveness for. Which is why, by the way, I mentioned the two greatest commandments, because those are so all-inclusive, everybody knows they break those all the time.
Yes.
So some people say, well, I didn't lust after a woman today. And if it's a guy, I'm saying that's because you've been in a coma all day, probably. But so let's listen, maybe you didn't do that. But that doesn't mean you haven't committed some other kind of other kind of sin. So that's what I want them to see. I'd want to press upon them the logic of their own view. Okay, so that's the way I deal with that. Anyway, got to run to another call. Lou, thank you for your call. Let's go to Buffalo, New York. Elijah, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hey, Greg, how's it going?
Hey, good. Thanks.
I'm a longtime podcast listener and a huge fan. I have two things for you. One is more of a statement, like a story, and the other one's a question.
Okay.
So I recently have been talking to my youth pastor. I'm a youth leader at my church,
uh-huh.
And I've been talking to my youth pastor, and he wanted me to do some kind of a apologetics curriculum with the youth group.
Uh-huh.
And so I convinced him to use the church's budget to buy the ABC curriculum.
Oh,
so
good!
Bought all three packages.
Wow.
I listened through all of those, and I'm actually in the middle of turning them into a curriculum for the youth group.
Good for you.
The kids love it. It's awesome.
I'm so glad. And I tip my hat to you because I'm not clever with curriculum. I just gave those talks and gave you my notes, and we just kind of bundled everything together for the ABCs. And I'm thrilled when somebody like you, and this has happened before, but they'll take this and then they'll modify it. They'll make a curriculum out of it. They'll break it down into chunks and pieces so they can teach it to youth. And I'm especially glad that they're enjoying it. So I have another recommendation for you, by the way, off the top of my head. And
okay.
This isn't our product, but we sell it, and it's called True You. True.
Actually, my college group went through that. We own that as a church.
Dynamite. Okay, good.
Yeah. So depending on the level of the youth group, as of right now, we have a really young group.
Uh-huh.
So True You is pretty, like, you know, it's pretty up there as far as like intellectual.
Oh, okay. Things. I hadn't thought that was the case, but you're the best one to make those judgments.
Yeah, so, at least for my youth group anyway. We have, like, a lot of 7th, 8th, 9th graders.
Oh, I got you.
One or two seniors. So
uh-huh.
With a couple of them, they'll seek me out on every Wednesday night, and they'll say, Elijah, come here. I have a story to tell you. This one kid told me today that there's no such thing as truth, and my first response was, is that true?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, refuting self-refuting statements and stuff. And it was really cool, too, because, you know, I taught the whole burden of proof in the tactics
uh-huh.
lesson that I gave, which
wow.
actually I used tactics as like my first lesson,
uh-huh.
and then I'm you know talking about tactics with almost every single lesson too. Uh-huh. So they're really getting it.
That's really great. Well, because that and the ABCs, the tactics teaching is an older version of the tactics. So I'm glad it's helping. Tell me what's on your mind though, Elijah.
Okay, I'm a student right now. I'm an undergraduate, about two semesters away from my bachelor's degree in biology with a minor in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm being confronted a lot with, like, the evolution stuff.
Right.
And I was listening to, like, Alvin Plantinga and William Lane Craig's talks and stuff like that on theistic evolution.
Right.
And I noticed that in a couple of the other calls that you had, you kind of compared theistic evolution to sort of like boiling a water with just adding a leprechaun.
Yes.
but they've made an analogy where like sort of like an author of a story where God is the author of the universe. So in like a story, there will be the author will plan something out, but according to the storyline, it's a random event. But according to the author, it's not random. He planned it. And so I guess my question would be, what do you think of that kind of a thing, thinking about God in relation to the universe as the author? You know, so asking the question, what caused this particular thing could be both. It is random for us, but yet God also planned it.
All right. Let me give some thoughts just off the top of my head. The first one is, remember that illustrations are not arguments. They're just kind of fancy assertions. That's not a put down. It's just to be clear on what we're dealing with. And the illustrations are only valuable if they are appropriately parallel to the thing in question.
Sure.
Okay, so if the material world and biological realm is similar to what to like a story that God is writing, it turns out that in a story, the author directly and decisively determines every single step. Now, because it's a narrative, we know that there seem to be random elements that come together, but that has to do with the fiction of the story itself. I think the better parallel here is in the coherence of the words. So you have an author who writes a story, and the story is certain words in certain orders that gives particular meanings. That is more a precise kind of parallel to the biological development of life. If you jump into the random elements of the narrative of the story, now you're moving into an element of the illustration that doesn't apply to biology.
Okay.
It is more like an author writing a book. And in order for the words to mean something, they have to be in a particular order. And that's a very good parallel to, say, proteins that have to be amino acids in a certain order to make the protein that does certain functions. But this is an argument for intelligent design. So I guess I'm going to want to say that the author book illustration fits the intelligent design motif better than it does in terms of its propriety as an illustration, better than it fits the motif of Darwinian evolution. And so I don't think that's going to help people. I don't think it is a good illustration because the illustration they're using, the way they're using it, is not parallel with the dynamic of the development of life in a Darwinian sense.
Right, yeah. I mean, as somebody who studies biology, I totally get the problems with Darwinian evolution. I would consider myself more of a, I don't know, progressive creationist or something like that. I thought it was interesting.
Being
the author.
Well, think in mind, and I know this, I just came off from a little writing task last week. Authors labor to get the words right. Even if the words tell a story in which there seem to be random events, those events are placed there on purpose by authors. They are purposeful. Right. There's teleology to stories. So using the story metaphor doesn't rescue somebody from, you know, the challenge about the leprechaun. It seems to me that biology is a story. It is a very precisely written story that requires intelligence to put words in very particular orders to get the outcomes that the author has in mind. So the story metaphor is a metaphor that applies to my view as a person who believes in intelligent design. It is not a metaphor that applies well to the other side's view, which is the Darwinian view. Does that make sense to you?
Right. Yeah, it makes sense. So it would apply more, thinking just purely on the large-scale Darwinian evolution thing, would the story metaphor or story analogy apply more to like a full-scale teleological, like, you know, it starts off from the single cell way back when and there is a story written, as opposed to just the random Darwinian thing, I guess, right?
Well, what I'd want to say at that point is that if you have the origin of life, that origin of life, which I think needs to be designed, is a modest amount of information. Let's just say that's the first chapter. Let's say it's the first paragraph of your book, of your story. Well, you get the first paragraph, but you know what? That's not your story. In order to get your whole story, you've got to write more, which means you have to add more information. And by parallel, in the biological realm, you've got this first life, which is simple by comparison to complex life. It's still pretty complex, but it's only the first part. In order to get the rest, you have to add more information. In order to get the whole biosphere, you have a lot more words that need to be added. And this is your kind of progressive creation element. So I still think the story illustration is apt for our circumstance, but you can't get the whole story out of the first paragraph. The writer has to keep adding information, and I think the same thing's true with the development of life. That first life was fairly simple in terms of its information compared to the biosphere that we have now. At subsequent stages, new information has to be injected into the biosphere, and on a genetic level, we know that now. Darwin didn't know that, but we know that. In order for the biosphere to develop, so that means subsequent interjections of an intelligent agent, the naturalistic processes are not going to be adequate to account for that new information. You know what biologists say, and they say this is mutation, genetic mutation. That's neo-Darwinism. That's where you get the new information. But they've never demonstrated that genetic mutation can get you the kind of information you need to finish the story.
Right, and even like scientists like Doug Axe over at the Biologic Institute have actually demonstrated the opposite, where like if you need 7 mutations to change something, you can never get it in the whole history of the entire universe.
That's right. Yeah, on the just taking their system at face value, you're not going to get what you want. There's so many things wrong with the Darwinian model, I think, if for people who are honest with the evidence, but the mechanism is a huge one. I almost never talk about this, but the mechanism is a huge one. And by the way, this is where you can go back to your illustration about the story, because let's just say we have someone who writes the story. So this is the theistic evolutionist who believes that God's involved, and minimally God's got to be involved to initiate the story. That's the origin of life, because that's a complex thing. You're not going to get that from naturalistic mechanisms. So okay, let's.
And it needs information.
Yeah, it needs information. So that's your first paragraph. Now, do you think when you write a story, you could say, okay, I got my first paragraph, I wrote it, and now it's got a, I have a trajectory in mind where the story's going to go. So now I can just put my two-year-old at the typewriter, and the two-year-old can just start banging the keys, right? That's chance.
Right.
And you're going to get something coherent to tell the rest of the story. Well, you know it's not going to happen. And I'm the parallel here between the two-year-old is with mutation. Mutation doesn't give you meaningful things. And I know that Darwinists want to argue that we have a mechanism for separating out the meaningful thing, and that is natural selection. But it presumes you got to have something meaningful to select out. And if your mechanism does not characteristically produce meaningful sentences, then even if you have natural selection to select the meaningful things, there's not going to be much to select. And then, of course, this is a massive problem in the system, in my view.
Right, yeah, no, I totally get it. My thoughts were mainly on the large scale, like, you know, where does God kind of fit in the theistic evolution framework if he planned out the whole story? And then it could look random to us, but I totally understand what you're saying. I get it.
That might be an explanation, and this is what you've asked the question that I think that theistic evolutionists have to answer, and that is if you
right.
say that God used it, you've got to give God a meaningful role. And if you say God then planned the whole thing out, but it looks random,
it's almost like an unfalsifiable proposition.
Yes, that's part of the problem. But I don't think it looks random, for goodness sake. I mean, this is a question about the assessment of the issue, of the broad facts themselves. You know, well, it looks random. Really? It looks random? That's what the evolutionists want to say, but it sure doesn't look random to me. And when you look go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, you know, when you look at natural selection happening today, we actually see things where, like, a whole ton of organisms will die in a population, and there's only a tiny little portion of that develop a one or two base pair change that actually is beneficial. So in that case, it almost looks like it was not planned, the evolution was not planned, but there is a mechanism of change to in order to adapt to an environment. So I would say that those very, very minor, small changes do, in fact, look random. But as far as the big picture, like, you know, say the evolution of photosynthesis, there's no way that same mechanism could have resulted in the same thing.
Look, as a person who is believes in intelligent design, I am completely comfortable with the mechanism of natural selection working on even occasional mutations or whatever to produce something novel that may be beneficial, and that there is, and one might even argue that this is a design feature in the whole biological realm. You got a little noise in the background there. I don't know if there's any possibility to resolve that.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm actually in the most secluded room in my church right now.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Let out.
Okay, that sounds a little quieter there. That's good.
I'm in the corner.
Yeah, I think it's entirely possible for natural selection within a limited range to accomplish some things, and you can see it working. I do not deny microevolution. But the question is, how much can it do? That's the key to me. One might even argue that natural selection is a design thing, a feature itself, and some people have argued that way, that it is a design mechanism that allows for limited change in response to changing environmental conditions. But it can only account for limited change. Some things can't be accounted for by that, and this is where the macroevolution issue, I think, looms as a huge problem that no microevolution mechanism is adequate to account for.
Right. And I totally get that. Actually, an engineer friend of mine was like, I cannot believe the amazing features of natural selection, because that's what we engineers want to be able to do, is to make it so that the things that we design are, you know, they adapt by themselves. And God has done that through natural selection, but right, there are some things that process cannot do.
Yeah. So that is an excellent example, though, of something that is inherent to the Darwinian project that itself smacks of natural selection. I mean, of intelligent design. And
right,
so if this this mechanism is truly operating the way that you say it's operating, well, then I think we've got really fantastic evidence right there that someone's there behind the curtain making things happen.
Definitely. Okay. All right. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Yes, Elijah, it's a pleasure talking to you, and all the best with your youth group.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right. It's always great to hear back from people that are working at these things, applying them in, with the group, and adapting the stuff that we have. I mean, there are programs that we have, like I mentioned, TrueU, that are certainly effective just out of the package for training youth. And indeed, there's actually two things now that TrueU has out. And Steve Meyer is the instructor for that. Two things. One of them is on the existence of God, and then the second one is on the authority of the Bible. So I highly recommend those products. But you can take our stuff that aren't in a kind of a turnkey form. We have some of those too, our own, like the tactics material or Making Abortion Unthinkable, the Art of Pro-Life Persuasion. But you can go and take any of our other teachings. You can take any of our other material. You can take our ABCs. You can take any other talks we have. In most of them, I include the notes there on a PDF file. If you want to go ahead and make something and adapt it for your group, for your Bible study, for your youth group, you are free to do that. And we are really, really excited when people get creative and improve on our materials. They're certainly capable of doing that. We know that more can be added. Well, it's time to say goodbye to our Southern California audience. For the rest of our stations, please stay with us. We'll be taking more of your calls after the break as usual. Final segment here on Stand to Reason. Some people hanging on for a long time want to get right to. So let's go to Detroit, Michigan. And this is Christopher. Hi, Christopher. Greg Kokel.
Hi, Greg. First time, long time, although I had the pleasure of meeting you at Abdul Murray's fundraiser.
Oh, yeah, right. That was earlier this year.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, and thank you for taking my question today. I am, I guess, soteriologically speaking, I'm a non-Calvinist, and but the majority of my friends are Calvinists, and people that
you hang with a good crowd, don't you?
Right, people that I admire greatly, such as yourself, are Calvinists, but I just don't get it, and that drives me. It drives me crazy because I consider myself a student of the Bible, and so. You know, I'm just trying to kind of working through this. I consider myself one that's already worked through it and kind of fallen on the other side of the line. But I consider myself still open-minded enough where
good
someone can explain this thing to me where it makes sense.
Okay.
Then I'll join in.
All right.
Per se.
What is it that you just don't get? I mean, when you say I don't get it, what specifically do you mean by that?
Well, I guess what I don't get is I see certain passages in scriptures within a text that seems to point to humans having libertarian freedom, and I just don't see libertarian freedom as being compatible with
election.
The way that with the way that if God sovereignly chooses, then I don't feel like I didn't legitimately choose. And so I didn't legitimately make a choice, not to compare my ability to God's ability, but just to say,
no, I understand
a straightforward reading of the scriptures. Those are the libertarian.
Right. And I do think you are right in suggesting that libertarian freedom on the salvation question is inconsistent with sovereign grace and election in the Calvinistic or Reformed sense. I think you're right there. I think you're mistaken in saying if God makes a choice for me, that somehow that choice also can't, I can't make a choice for God. That is a meaningful choice. And that, I think, is maybe where we're going to have a difference. Ultimately, okay, though, the issue comes down to what the Scripture teaches on this issue. That is, yeah, regardless of what it says about human beings choosing, is there anything that we see in Scripture that seems to be unequivocal that God himself is the decisive agent in our salvation? I think the answer is to that question is yes. There's quite a number of passages that seem unequivocal. That is, there's no other way to take them. And I see them in John 6, and I see them in John 10, and actually quite in Ephesians 1, different ways of taking different passages. And so then it comes down to this question of, can God make a decision for me that guarantees the outcome, and still me make a decision that is a meaningful decision too? And I think I have a way of explaining that. Did you want to hear it?
Yeah, I'll listen.
Okay, when you make a decision to sin, are you making, I mean, broadly speaking, a decision here that you could have done otherwise? That is, as a fallen person, can you live a sinless life if you choose to?
No.
No. You end up choosing sin. And I'm just putting this out there. I know you're going to agree with me here, but you end up choosing sin, and it's a real choice. But the reason that you're choosing sin is because your nature is fallen. Is that a fair way of putting it? Yes. And so the choice to sin is an inevitable result of your fallen nature.
Right.
Okay. So we are in our fallen natures because of the first Adam. The first Adam caused the circumstances in which our fallen natures result in sin, in which we are choosing to sin, though it's not the case that we could have done otherwise. We're sinners by nature. Now, if that makes sense, and I think it does entirely, why is it that God can't then, with the second Adam, change our nature so that our nature is not in rebellion against him, but is in concert with him, and then we choose to believe in him, consistent with this change that God has made in us? Isn't that still a real decision, just as real as our decision to follow our nature to sin?
I guess where it loses me is in him changing our nature before we choose. But I guess if I looked at the tulip, I would have...
Leave tulip out just for a second, because I don't want to get those maybe what might be artificial categories in here. I'm just looking at the basics of it. Okay, so how does he change my nature? We know from, say, Romans 3 that we are in rebellion against God, and that is the state of our nature. And there, if God doesn't do anything, we're sunk. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I agree.
Based on Romans 3. So you and I already both agree that God's got to do something to intervene. Now, the real question is, does he act and take us halfway, or does he act and take us all the way? That's the real question. We both believe that God intervenes in our nature in some way, because if we didn't, we'd be completely lost. Does he bring us up even so that we don't have a sin nature that's interfering with our rebellion, or does he take us all the way and change our nature so that we then choose him? That's the real question.
I don't know. I guess that's the question that I struggle with in my mind. I'm not sold on that not being a false dichotomy, because of the libertarian type passages.
Well, I'm not sure if the question is whether they're libertarian or not, if they're describing libertarian freedom or not. The way you find out whether a thing is a false dichotomy is by coming up with the third option. If you can't come up with a third option, then there's no reason not to stick with the dichotomy that I offered. You and I both believe that human beings are fully fallen and their wills are against God. And nothing we can do can change that. Nothing we do directly. God has got to do something, right? Or else we will continue rebelling.
Yes.
Okay, so then the question is, does God take it halfway and therefore kind of bring us up even Stephen and then we make a libertarian choice? Or does God take us all the way? Now, I know what you want to say. You want to say, well, I think he takes us halfway because then we make the libertarian choice. But my question then is going to be, where in Scripture do we have testimony to the fact that God acts in his Holy Spirit to bring everybody halfway, when all of the testimony of Scripture is either describing a completely fallen man in complete rebellion against God, Romans 3, or a person who is regenerate and fully following God according to the kind intention of God's will and his election? I don't see any scriptural evidence for the halfway work of God. That's what I'm saying. You're inferring it from what you think is a libertarian choice, but it seems to me that if God is going to move, the scripture will describe the nature of the move. And either I see no move at all or a complete move when the scripture describes the Holy Spirit's action. I don't see it describing halfway action.
Can I give a text
yes,
to get your commentary on it?
Yes, sir. You've been very patient with me.
I was originally going to ask you about the Romans chapter 9 passage, but it's fine if that's what you would prefer, since I gave it that, and I don't know if you've looked at it ahead of time. But the Acts chapter 17 passage on Mars Hill, I think it's like 26 and 27, And what would be your commentary? You can take the whole chapter or whatever.
Well, what we see is that Paul is giving his argument, and his attempt and his purpose is to persuade. And God uses this in the minds of some people, and he doesn't use it in the minds of other people. That's all. I mean, that's what I see there. We have all kinds of statements like there about human agents using arguments that people respond to. The ultimate question, though, is not whether people respond to arguments, because we know they do. The question is, what is it that's working behind the scenes to change them or to affect their utter fallenness, in which they are not pursuing God at all, Romans 3, to a state of mind where they are responding positively to the gospel? And we actually have a statement in the book of Acts to that effect, to tell us, well, what makes the ultimate difference? And the text says that God opened Lydia's heart to believe the gospel. That is, we see God making an active move to change her thinking, or change something about her, not to change her thinking, change something in her, so that she responded then to the proclamation of the gospel instead of ignored the proclamation of the gospel and kept in her rebellion.
So, back to the 17:26. It almost seems to me that it's a kind of a disingenuous remark to say that God did this so that we might reach out to him and find him, though he is not far from us. That seems to me like if that's not a legitimate, you know, option, that it's in a sense that will be Paul just telling somebody something that's not true.
God consistently offers salvation and grace and mercy to people he knows are not going to take it. I don't think it's disingenuous. It's very, very genuine. But we see this in the book of Ezekiel and lots of other places. God knows people. Jesus offers the bread to Judas, and he knows Judas is going to betray him. So anyway, it's a tough issue. And Christopher, I appreciate your call and give me a chance to explain some things and work through this a little bit. That's it for the show, friends. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. You give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.